Hello, everyone. Good evening, and welcome to our monthly meeting. So let us begin with the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Someday. Okay, may we have a roll call, please?
Good evening, Commissioner. Roll call. Chair Hartwig.
I am present.
Vice Chair Hurd.
Present.
Commissioner Castillo. Commissioner Griggs Murphy.
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery.
Present.
And Commissioner Jung Lee.
Present.
And Commissioner Griffith.
Present.
Thank you.
All right, do we have a motion to approve the minutes from the last meeting?
I so move.
Moved, seconded. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Any abstentions, dissents? Okay, carries unanimously. Old or unfinished business?
There is none.
And I know of none either. Are there any modifications to the agenda? No. Okay, then we are going to move forward into new business. And so we will begin now with item A.
Good evening, commissioners. Item A is just a welcoming of a new commissioner. Ann Griffith has been appointed by the Board of Commissioners and was approved by the City Council in December and sworn in middle of January. She brings 20 years of experience in delivering awareness and investment and community revitalization to the board, a real capacity. She knows Oakland well. She's worked in San Francisco for the Hope SF program, currently as employed by Enterprise Community Partners, a wonderful group that provides consulting to a lot of folks in town. We're grateful for her expertise, and I just wanted to put something on the agenda because in the past we don't do this, and I just want to recognize for the record that we have new talent on the board and give you an opportunity to say hello.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Thanks. We are happy to have you. All right. Moving on to item B.
Item B, and actually the following three items. Item B is the 2017 Resident Advisory Board nominations. This year we have 27 names coming forward for nomination, our Resident Advisory Board. I'm happy to see some expansion. I'm happy to see some new members joining us. I think I see a concurrence by Betty Lou, right, who is one of our most active and engaged volunteer and seniors in this agency, and I think that we all are really appreciative of the seniors who are willing to commit their time and their energy and their expertise to help us become a better agency. It's a rough road we have ahead, and we need all the help we can get. Having said that, we're here for any questions. We've included bios, and I have no speaker cards. I don't know if anyone who's on the nomination wishes to speak, but we haven't received any cards.
So are any of them here tonight?
I don't see any. No.
Okay.
Oh, good. Thank you. We'll see if any of these are. So these are not, by the way.
Okay.
These look like they apply to public comment for the plan. So I'm going to hear them at the next item.
Okay. So did you move?
Okay, so good. That concludes my report. I'm here for any questions.
Comment?
Okay, good. You have a comment? Yes, please.
I think I've been sitting on the Resident Advisory Board for over 10 years. Let's start there. But we have, over the last 5 years, have really wanted it to include people from our different places, and it finally does. We have folks from the the home ownership, two people who graduated from our home ownership program, 14 Section 8 participants, three PBV participants, and eight public housing residents. And I think that's just really represents the diversity of our city and our agency. And I'm so proud to be able to sit on this board as long as I have to see this change come to fruition. So really good work on the outreach efforts of our family and community partnerships, and also so grateful for our residents to step in and share that time with us and give us their precious feedback and experience to this, to making sure that we run this organization as it should be for the people. Thank you.
Yes, one comment. I just have one comment.
Pardon? Did you have a comment?
Just one comment.
Yes, sure.
Thank you. As I was reading through all the bios, I was really impressed with the level of commitment to our community each of these residents has. I'm really thrilled to see all that. And welcome them aboard, and I'll move the item.
Okay.
I'll second it.
It has been moved and seconded. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, carries.
Great, thank you, commissioners.
Okay, we are on to the next item now, item C.
Item C and the next two items are related. Item C is a public hearing on the proposed Oakland Housing Authority fiscal year 2018 Making Transitions Work Plan. The next two items, item D, and is a public hearing on our admissions plan for the Section 8 program. And the last item that's related is item E, which is a public hearing on our ACOP, which applies to public housing, and that's the Housing Authority Mission and Continued Occupancy Plan. We're going to have a presentation on all three items because they're all related. Then we're going to have to open and close the public hearing for each one of the items once we get done. But we'll start with hearing a presentation, and I'd like to introduce Dominica Henderson, who's our Director of Planning, Implementation, and Compliance, who will go through a PowerPoint and address any questions you want to make now. This is the public hearing. This will return to the board in the first week in April, which is actually our March meeting, I think it's April 4th, for approval, and it has to be submitted to HUD shortly thereafter to meet their deadlines. So, Dominica, do you want to?
Well, I just wanted to ask, since we have two speakers for this, maybe it would be a good idea to have the speakers talk first.
It's absolutely fine if the speakers want to talk. They might want to hear the presentation to inform what they say, and then we can take the speakers after the presentation. One of the speakers is talking about the smoking policy, which only adheres to the public housing tenants, so that would be mm-hmm. the last item, item E, and should be heard during that public comment period. In other words, that's why we open up the public comment. They want to make that during the public comment period.
Okay.
The other one looks like it applies to all the admissions plan. It said something about a five-day notice. So
or
that one,
rent,
I think,
rent on the 5th.
Yeah.
Rent
that,
due
that
by
would
the
be
fifth
under the admissions plan in Section 8, so we put that in the next item. And so we'll open up the public comment, because what will happen is we record the comments, they go into the plan, and then we respond to them in the plan.
And we'll be able to respond to the comments.
Yeah, in the plan.
We okay, so respond. Then why don't we do it that
yeah,
way?
We don't respond now. We actually put it in the
all
plan.
Right, so all
we
right, then we'll start with the presentation.
Their comments under consideration before
then,
we publish
great.
The final plan. Okay?
Okay. Good evening, commissioners. My name is Dominica Henderson, and I will be presenting the fiscal year 2018 MTW Moving to Work Annual Plan. As part of the annual plan this year, we have included the admissions and continued occupancy policy for the public housing program and the Housing Choice Voucher Administrative Plan as appendices to the published document. So the MTW plan, the admin plan, and the ACOP, and the public housing tenant lease, all those revisions and proposed changes have been published to the authority's website. This presentation will cover all three of the policy documents as well as some changes to the lease. The MTW plan, and in addition to that, this presentation will follow the similar format as the MTW plan, so we'll go section by section and explain what the contents of those different sections are. The MTW plan is laid out with an introduction. We give an overview of our general housing information. We provide a list of our proposed and description of our proposed activities, We also then go into Section 4, which are the approved MTW activities, which is the bulk of the document, the sources and uses, or the budget that we intend to implement during fiscal year 2018. And we wrap it up with the administrative section and a number of appendices. We also added a few appendices this year. The fiscal year 2018 MTW plan will be implemented for July 1, 2017 through June 30, 2018. So this is our plan for the year. We generally come back to you in September for the reporting on the performance under the plan of the previous year. So this plan will go for next year. Section 1 is the introduction. In the introduction, we discuss the overview of the MTW demonstration, an overview of OHA's participation in the demonstration. We also provide a general overview of the Oakland Housing Authority's expectations in terms of our short-term goals for the fiscal year, our long-term goals that we expect to implement throughout several MTW plan years. And we provide a sort of general synopsis of how we intend to meet the statutory objectives of the MTW program, which you see here. On the screen, the statutory objectives of increasing housing choice for low-income families, providing incentives for families with children to become economically self-sufficient, and reducing costs and achieving greater cost effectiveness. Those are statutory objectives that were created by Congress and are administered by HUD. And so each of the MTW activities that we describe and have proposed in our MTW plan meet at least one, usually more than one, but at least one of these objectives. And so the introduction just gives an overview of how we intend, on a high level, how we intend to meet these objectives. Section 2 describes the planned number of families served. This slide you see in front of you is the maximum projected number of families served. This is our entire capacity. In Section 2, we describe what we expect to accomplish in fiscal year 2018. So you'll see in Section 2, what we talk about, we expect between a 92% up to 96% utilization rate for Housing Choice Voucher program. We expect about a 97% lease-up rate and occupancy rate for public housing. And then we also describe our attempt to make up the difference in the number of families served through our local non-traditional programs, our sponsor-based housing assistance program, and all of the programs that we call local non-traditional or very Oakland-specific programs. And then in addition to those units, we have other MTW units, which are our low-income tax credit units, which are unassisted through the traditional Housing Choice Voucher or public housing subsidy, but they are part of our MTW portfolio. So in total, from this slide, you see we have 15,468 units or vouchers that we could serve in a maximum at any point in time. And throughout fiscal year 2018, we expect to really use some of the MTW flexibilities we have to increase the number of families served on this local non-traditional side so that our Housing Choice Voucher families, because we realize that there are some challenges with the local market, so that those families have some assistance through our landlord incentives to be able to locate units. So where we may have a lower than usual utilization rate on the Housing Choice Voucher side, we expect to be able to make that up through project basing, and then also through some of our local programs. Section 3 is pretty short because we don't propose any new activities for fiscal year 2018. So I'll just move on to Section 4, which is the description of our approved MTW activities. An MTW activity, I just want to make clear, is an activity where we've applied to HUD to seek a waiver from traditional HUD regulations to do it in a way that we feel best meets the local needs. And so there are several activities that either we're revising to localize them a little bit because they are more cost effective, they're more efficient, or it may be in the case of some of our local programs, expanding and increasing housing opportunities. So some of the existing approved activities that we have that we cite here are, we're proposing a few amendments to some of the approved activities. So we just want to make sure that HUD is clear that we are every year refining our activities more and more so that we're able to become more efficient with our time and more efficient with our funds so that we're able to use those better in other areas. Under the alternative recertification schedules activity, we expect to, or we hope to propose to use a new revised form for a consent form. So HUD has a required consent form that we are required to have families sign every year, every 15 months. We hope to be able to make the consent form match the recertification period so that when a family who's a triennial family, they may get recertified every 3 years, we don't want to have to, every 15 months, send them a new form to have them provide their consent because we're not doing a recertification. So it helps save time, it helps save money for us on sending out those forms, but it also helps us to be consistent with the family so that they know every 3 years they'll hear from us on the same thing. And it's not every, it's not a period that's inconsistent with their recertification period. We also, with that, want to offer the flat rent for public housing families on the same schedule as their annual recertification. So really what we're finding is that as staff go through their daily activities, we are finding ways where we can save time, save staff time, but also save residents from having to come to the office, fill out recertification paperwork, things like that, and making sure that we're capitalizing on our interaction with the family so that we're being as efficient as possible. So this is one of those activities. The other activity is in line with that, the standardized transfer policy, where we hope to, in instances where we're transferring families from public housing to the Housing Choice Voucher Program or some instance like that where they're already an admitted family in one of our programs, we hope to minimize the minimize the screenings for the minimum mandatory program requirements so that we eliminate the duplicative screening process that we put families through when we're transferring families. They're already in our system, so we want to make sure that we're not asking them to complete paperwork that they've already submitted to us and makes it a little bit more streamlined for our own internal operations as well. We also have our owner's incentives and automatic rent increase initiative that was approved last year. So we expect to implement pieces of both of these activities in order to retain landlords that are currently participating in our program that we hope to as well recruit some new landlords through our various incentives. We have new PBV allocations for existing units from the RFQs that have come through in the past few months, as well as today, I believe. So we expect to use that activity to increase the number of PBV units that are allowed under our portfolio and also expand the time limits on the contracts that are allowed for project-based voucher units. We have an SRO preservation program activity to provide service-enriched housing for special populations, and so we estimate that about 289 families will be served under this activity. This would qualify as one of the local programs that we've created, and so it's not under the Housing Choice Voucher model that most of our families fit in. And then the last activity we have is the local housing assistance programs. So when we in the MTW plan describe local housing assistance program, it fits a number of the special programs, special needs housing programs that we have. So in addition to MOMS, in addition to sponsor-based, we're also expecting to implement the Building Bridges activities, which are the special needs. The special needs committee met last year and has the Oakland Housing Authority is currently working with the Alameda County Department of Social Services to implement the CalWORKS and the THP Plus foster youth program. And so we're hoping to begin with serving 30 families under the Building Bridges model, and then have an additional local program that we've been implementing since disposition to serve the families that were over income from the disposition, but we still currently subsidize. They are neither in public housing or in Section 8. So that's sort of a brief overview of some of the larger activities that we have in the MTW plan. We have 26 activities, so each one of them is described in the plan, are what we expect to accomplish under those, and then the metrics that we're required to track when we have those activities and report on under the annual report. In Section 5, we talk about the budget priorities for the fiscal year. We anticipate that the budget priorities will mirror those of fiscal year 2017. Given the changes with the federal government, there's a little bit of uncertainty as to the direction of funding and the direction of just policy in general with HUD. And so we really have our budget priorities lined up, and the actual budget that you see is the same as what we proposed and got approved in 2017. The budget will be coming to you as a separate item in the next couple of board meetings. And so what we generally do is put an asterisk by our budget projections and let HUD know that, because our budget cycle doesn't necessarily line up with their MTW plan cycle, we will update it and provide them the updated numbers as you approve them in May and June. So we can, though, state that the priorities are pretty similar. We expect to preserve and enhance OHA's housing portfolio, promote resident empowerment and self-sufficiency, provide a consistent level of security to OHA residents, expand affordable housing opportunities, increase the number of families served, simplify program requirements, and increase service-enriched housing through systems alignment. So these are the priorities that we use to direct which activities we'll use, and also then which activities we'll fund during the fiscal year. The timeline, that Section 6 describes the timeline that we expect for the public comment period for the MTW plan. So we had a resident advisory meeting at the beginning of February. We published public comment a couple weeks ago. We notified our community partners. We published a notice last week in the Oakland Tribune of this public hearing and also of the public comment period. We're having the public hearings today. We'll be at the resident advisory board again on Thursday just to talk to them about their potential comments that they may have had. So they've had the longest to take a look at the plan so far. And then after the RAB, we expect the public comment period to end on March 16th. And that's when we will collect all those comments, identify the responses, the appropriate responses in the plan, and then make them incorporated so that the plan that you see on April 3rd at the next board meeting will incorporate all of those comments that we receive from the RAB and also from other public members of the public. Section 6 is a little longer this year than normal because we are finding that there are a variety of things that people come to us and ask throughout the year and that may be helpful to include in our plan. So we have the glossary, the capital fund expenditures list, project-based voucher allocations, which is getting longer and longer the more PBV allocations we have each year. We also have a list of our housing inventory that shows our MTW programs and also shows some of the non-MTW portfolio as well, because a lot of people have questions about how many families we're serving under non-MTW programs. We include the comments from the Resident Advisory Board. We include the evidence of public process, which includes all of the public comments that we might receive from non-RAB members of the public. We also have our updated replacement housing factor plan and some new appendices, which are the language assistance plan. So some of the changes in the admin plan and in the ACOP reflect the new changes to going from a LEP plan in separate documents to one program-wide language assistance plan. We also included the Alameda County income limits and fair market rents. We have the public housing flat rent policy that is included as Appendix J, and the smoke-free public housing policy that's included as well. So in the final, we will have through Appendix K, and as I mentioned, we also included the ACOP, the admin plan, and the lease as appendices for this publication, but they don't go in the final document because they're very long. So we do separate those out when they're finally approved. I wanted to just generally go over some of the various policy issues that are addressed in the MTW plan, in the admin plan, and for the ACOP. In the MTW plan, as I mentioned, we are updating the standardized transfer policy, and we streamlined the language for the language assistance plan. So you'll see in the back that language assistance plan is something new, and we hope that to implement that across all programs for MTW programs, for non-MTW programs like MOD Rehab, or for our VASH, we also anticipate using the same language assistance program to inform our residents and applicants that we provide assistance for limited English proficiency families. And so those are the main policy items that have changed under the MTW plan. Under the Housing Choice Voucher Plan, we have most of our families are served under the Housing Choice Voucher Program. We have the administrative plan, which refines some language regarding the use of arrest records in background screening. So you'll see that we are trying to mirror more what we got some guidance from the White House. We also got some guidance from HUD last year, at the end of last year. And so what we want to do is mirror and refine our language to look more like what the regulations require, so that we are making sure that we're allowing as many families as possible the opportunity to apply for affordable housing. We realize that there are many people in the United States, many Americans have criminal arrest records, and so we want to make sure that we're not by violating any fair housing laws, obviously, and we're not by virtue of someone having been arrested limiting their opportunity towards affordable housing. So that is consistently throughout the document, the admin plan, and the ACOP, something that was revised. And then also a large change is that we increased the search times for voucher families so that they don't have to come back as quickly when they're out searching. It gives staff a little bit of a reprieve from having to approve those requests, but it also gives families more time to do those searches because we know it's necessary. A lot of families have come back and requested extensions, and so we have made the policy line up with what we're seeing the trend for locally. And it gives us the flexibility to be able to bring the time back to 90 days if needed in the future. But for now, we want to increase it just so that families have a little bit more convenience and are not burdened with having to get extensions. For the public housing program and the ACOP, we have a new flat rent policy. This flat rent policy is regulatory. So before we've come to you in the past, I think maybe a year or two ago, and requested approval of a flat rent policy that phase flat rent over a certain period of time at different amounts, HUD eliminated that. And so the new flat rent policy essentially says if a family's income will increase as a result of the flat rent being aligned with the FMRs, then if it increases more than 35%, I'm sorry, with the fair market rates or the FMRs. So if a family's income increases more than 35%, then we have to offer them a phased flat rent. Otherwise, all families have to pay the same flat rent amount. So what we were doing was having to manage different flat rents for different families. It was quite complicated, and HUD has eliminated that through regulations and instead required all families to pay a flat rent, which is set at 80% of the fair market rent. So it's much higher than it has been in the past, and so a lot of families experience that increase. They always have the choice to go back to the income-based model, which means that it'll be based on 30% of their adjusted income. as opposed to the flat rent, which is just set at a certain amount for the bedroom size. So it doesn't affect a whole lot of families. It only applies to the public housing program. But the change, because it was phased and now it's essentially not, some families may experience an increase in their income. So that was a regulatory change that we had to implement. And I can try, and I think you have a question.
I'm sorry, in their income or in their rent?
In their rent, I'm sorry. Yes, so this is, yes, in their rent, I'm sorry about that. So this is a regulatory change, but we want to just make sure that it was clear to you all that that's something that we are implementing because we got this policy, I think, mid-year last year. So this is something that happened after we brought this ACOP to you last year. We also revised the tenant lease. We incorporated the smoke-free public housing changes in the tenant lease, which I'll talk about in just a second. And we also revised the policy around that's included in the lease around the grievance procedure to mirror the regulations. So there were some changes that happened on the regulatory level, and we just are incorporating those into the lease document as well. Those changes were noticed to the public housing sites that are impacted. We also posted the notice at all of the administrative buildings. So hopefully the lease changes will be that you'll see are evident in the next couple of slides. And now I'll just go to those so you can see what the smoke-free public housing policy is. We recently submitted, and you may have in your packets, we recently sent out about 1,200 letters to the public housing, the affected public housing tenants for the smoke-free public housing policy. This smoke-free public housing policy bans the use of prohibited products within 25 feet of affected buildings. So essentially, HUD has required, that all public housing buildings are smoke-free, with the exception of public housing units that are in mixed finance sites. So all the units that are at the Hope 6 sites are excluded from this policy. That's 25 feet of the building, 25 feet of the perimeter of the building, including backyards and side yards, and also administrative buildings. So in the case of the building above us, if there was a courtyard, because it's within the building, we can't, there couldn't be a designated smoking area in those areas as well. It's required for all households, so all households will have to execute a new lease. We have to implement it at the Adele Court, Campbell Village, Harrison, Lockwood, Oak Grove, North and South, Palo Vista, and Peralta. And the deadline is July 3rd, 2018. So we sent public notices regarding this hearing. We also sent public notices to all of the families just to announce that there's an opportunity to comment. We sent an FAQ and a frequently asked questions sheet, and we also sent a comment card requesting public comments if people wanted to write in their comments to us on the implementation of this new policy. We expect that we will roll it out. We provide the 30 days for public comment, and we have to provide at least another 30 days before the lease change would take effect for each family. So at the recertification, say a family has a recertification, this is February. So if their recertification happens in March, then they would have 30 days notice before this effect would take, and the new lease would take effect. So it wouldn't take effect until a month after they actually are informed by us through their recertification process.
And we did include at your desks, you have a copy of what was sent to all of the impacted families.
That's right. So we explain the restricted areas here, the units, the administrative buildings, community rooms, daycare facilities or laundry rooms, and all of the outdoor areas within 25 feet of the building. We mailed the packet, and in that packet, as I mentioned, there's a letter, an FAQ, and a postage paid postcard for all of the residents to be able to provide their written comments should they need it to, and it's no cost to them. And that concludes this presentation. I'm available to ask questions. I would also like to introduce Julie Christensen, who's also worked on the MTW plan, the admin plan, and the ACOP with me, and so she's available as well if there are any questions about specific items in the document. And with that, I will defer to the director.
Okay, yes, whatever. Okay,
yes, oh, you said that they will sign a new lease?
Yes.
What does that look like?
The lease
the new
is...
lease. Do we have a copy of that?
I think we do.
I think
so. You should
so.
At the
I
back
think
of the ACOP.
What does that look like?
So if you go to item E at the back, it will have the lease with the changes tracked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me grab
that. And it's right here. It starts with page one, the tenant lease.
Oh, is that? Okay, so is that? And the Hope 6, you said, are not included. That's 7 Hope 6 brought. Hope 6?
Yeah, they, Hope not 6? Just the Hope 6. Any mixed finance that it contains public housing are not okay. included. So Chestnut, Linden, Mandela, Lion Creek Crossing, Foothill Family, although they have public housing units, are not impacted by this rule.
Okay.
Right, and that does create a challenge because suddenly they have a different lease than the rest of the public housing.
That was going to be my second question. Yep. Okay. All right. Thank you. And that's it on that. And then I just had two questions on the MTW for the SROs. I'm really pleased that we're doing this. When I was homeless, and thanks to OHA, I went into an SRO. And look where I am today. So I'm really pleased to see that we are really going to do more work in the SRO area. And I'm just thrilled. When I was reading this, I was just moved to tears, you know, because that's how I came out of homeless. I wanted to do an SRO. So, and you, the 200, is it 269 families?
I think it
200,
was
289. Okay, and they're currently in an SRO?
No, what
or
we...
Or they're going to go into an SRO?
They well, yeah. What we expect is that we would serve 289 families through our SRO activities. So there may be existing families. It may not be exactly 289, but throughout the year, we expect about an average of 289 families to be served each month under this SRO activity.
And for that item was in December. If you remember, the SROs were approved. That's for in-place families who are eligible, and we anticipate there will be 100% eligibility.
Okay.
The only thing that really may preclude it is there are two lifetime prohibitions in programs that we will have to vet for. But assuming that they don't have those two in their background, they will be in the program.
Yeah.
And it'll, again, this and the project-based Section 8 award, which is actually on consent, are the second round, are actually for currently housed families. So they're vouchering in place, and in the case of SROs, it's moving them more into a public housing model. So they're not going to have a monthly voucher. It's going to be an operating agreement structured similar to a public housing subsidy every month. And we're going to get records from them. But the initial lease up is there. We're just going to require they go through the eligibility to make sure they're income eligible.
Okay. Great, great. One more comment. I just want to say I'm just really thrilled. When I was reading through this, how much we're doing to help people. It is just a blessing. I'm just moved to tears. And my comment is the MOS program, what we're doing with that, and the DAD, parents and children together. I love the name. It's just so beautiful. And I think you said directly we have one DAD that's going to be a part
of
that.
I think we have our first father moving on site, and we'll give an updated report. We have doubled the program size. They moved the program in December since our last meeting. So now they're in a 21-unit site in East Oakland, and there's some vacancies that we're currently filling through the programs, and we don't care which one they come from. The programs are still on the sheriff's side, the moms and dads, but we call our site the PACT site, which is parents and children together, and we're not defining families.
Awesome. That's it. Thank you, Dominica. Excellent report. Thank you very much.
Good. Any other questions? Questions? Yes, Barbara.
Yeah, I just need a little bit more clarification on the flat rent. Yeah, just kind of explain that a little bit more for me.
I will. So the public housing families have the option of an income-based rent, which is the rent that is based on their percentage of their income, or a flat rent. If a family's income is relatively high, we offer a flat rent, and if it's lower, they would choose the flat rent amount. Recently, what HUD discovered is that many public housing agencies' flat rents were what they thought lower than the fair market rent. And so now flat rents, public housing authorities were allowed to set their own flat rents based on whatever market conditions they analyzed. Now the public housing flat rent has a minimum of being 80% of the fair market rents. So whereas before, a one bedroom, let's say the fair market rent is $1,000, before our flat rents may have been $500 for a one bedroom. Now they would be required to be $800. And so we had a number of families that were on the flat rent. But because that increase, they didn't want to pay that difference. We did some special outreach to them and phased the increase. If it was more than 35%, we kind of staggered it so that they were just paying 10%, then 10%, then another 15%. HUD, in I think it was July, decided that model is not going to work. And so regulations require that we set it at 80% of the FMR. And if a family's income if the family's rent would be increased 35% or more, then we can phase it. If a family's rent would not increase 35%, then they have to go jump right up to that 80% level or the $800. So it really just changes, it eliminates the option to phase it for the families and makes us have to charge the higher rent, because most of the families' rents would not increase by more than 35%. And so we made that policy revision so that it's consistent with the regulations. And then we also wanted to make clear to the families that they always have the option of requesting the income-based rent, which would set it at a percentage of their income. And that's the hardship that they're essentially allowed, is that if you don't want to be on the flat rent any longer, you can always request the income-based, and we'll do a recalculation and determine the income-based amount. So the flat rent is changing because of regulations, and we're just trying to make sure that it's that we're accurately calculating what that increase would be, so that families are not experiencing something higher than 35% and having to absorb that burden themselves.
So is this across the board?
Just for public housing.
I know for public housing, mm-hmm. but okay.
So it's not across the board, meaning all families. Right now we probably have between 40 and 50 families on flat rent, but it impacts those 40 to 50 families only. All other families who are on the income-based rent would just be offered the new flat rent. And so if they want to stay on income-based, they could, or they would just have to pay the new flat rent, which is set at a higher amount.
Okay. So they have a choice.
They do have a choice.
And I believe last year we wrote them all when we were doing
this. We did. We did outreach last
year. We wrote each impacted family.
We
actually, prior to this meeting,
right.
We wrote everyone in. You know, make sure we're in contact if they had any questions, so they can make an informed decision of where mm-hmm. they wanted to be.
And any new family that would be admitted to public housing would only be offered the new flat rent amount that's set at the 80%. They would be offered either the income-based or the new flat rent amount, but they wouldn't be offered the lower amounts. Only the families that are currently on the flat rent would have the potential option of having the lower phased amount.
Can I have one more question
sure.
of clarity for flat rent?
Sure.
So it affects 40 to 50 families, but how much income do they have to have to even qualify to do flat rent? They're choosing this because it's cheaper than doing income-based?
That's right. That's exactly
over,
right.
Is there a certain amount that they make over that they can?
No, it's based on the bedroom size. It's set at 80% of the FMR for each bedroom size. So a family is presented with, this is your income-based amount. And what we've done this year for assuming that this, once the policy and the new flat rent policy is approved, we've set up sort of an activated calculation for the PAs and the different property management staff to be able to go through the calculations with the families. So they plug in the bedroom size, they say where they are, and then out of the machine, you know, out of the computer comes the amount that the family would have to pay for flat rent. Then they compare it to the income-based amount, and then the family can make a really, you know, informed decision and make the best judgment for their household.
But the increase in the flat rent was a result of HUD.
Yes, and Congress, and, really.
Yeah, and it was in the public housing program, we used to set a ceiling rent, and then it became a flat rent, and it was artificially low, probably below market. We didn't adjust it very much, if at all. That became very problematic for some people in the certain party in Washington. They wanted us to increase it. They thought that public housing families were making too much money and they should pay more or move.
Right.
I can tell you that I truly support having earned income in public housing sites. And I think, and I'll just, because I think we talked about this either last year or the year before. I don't remember when they did this. I'm getting too senile about that. But one of the reasons is very simple. If you have Lockwood Gardens, for example, we have a couple residents in Lockwood Gardens that make decent amount of money from South. They work at the airport, for example, at Southwest. When job vacancies become available there, if they know people in the neighborhood and they refer them, that's how people network in and find gainful employment and how you have a healthy neighborhood. If you, again, take all of the earned income out of large portions of a neighborhood, you have a severely distressed community, and you lose an economic network that helps everybody find their first, second, or a better job. So I think it's important to preserve earned income in all developments. Having a flat rent means that the income calculation stopped. This is the most we're going to charge. And what the HUD rule did is say it has to go up to 80% of the FMR. And that was an increase for us. And there were a number of households that were negatively impacted. Mm-hmm. And we did our analysis so we knew who those were and outreach to them. But I don't know that I support it, because I really would like to keep as much earned income and families networked into our neighborhoods. Keep in mind, these are acres of property and communities that need resources for the people living there. And one of those naturally occurring resources toward finding a job is other people who are working at other organizations. If you exclude that because you're going to say they have to move out, which was the initial proposal, by the way, that overincome public housing folks need to leave, you're perpetuating the problem with severely distressed neighborhoods, and you're not allowing them to become viable, economic, and thriving neighborhoods with healthy options. All right, and I do want to note that I've seen some people come in. If you'd like to speak, you need to fill out a yellow speaker card. I believe we should have an officer back there, Chief, if they can help. But we need to fill out a speaker card, and we'll get that to the speaker. We'll be opening public comment in a moment. All right.
Any more questions? Yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Yes.
This just shows the creativity and the response to a really deep need in our community. I just had a question about on number 9. We said we're going to increase the number of families served at the last meeting. I think we're going to push it to 98. But has the new administration caused us to be more prudent or? What are we talking about when we say increase the number of families served? Or do we have a percentage after that?
What we're going to propose in next year's budget is that we're going to serve 100% of the Section 8 households we're eligible to serve, plus the local programs on top of that.
Okay.
That's what we're going to propose. What Congress passes by September 30th, we hope, may impact that decision. But in our budget, I've asked Section 8 to budget for 100% of their voucher families so that we are maximizing the number of assistance we can provide people. I don't know that we'll get to 100 through the conventional program. Mm-hmm. If you know, we've awarded now almost 600 and some odd project-based vouchers, which should be online by the next fiscal year.
Yeah.
But I will talk about that at the end during director's comment, kind of how that math is and where we are. We are noticing there is a softening of the rental market, which is good. It's helping our families locate. I don't know what the future brings, but if that continues, we should have a better time of it. The challenge isn't our... The leasing issue is not us not wanting to lease. It's the lack of available apartments that will participate in the program.
That's why I'm saying we're going to serve more, but the
in the plan, we're not saying 100%. In our budget, okay. we're saying 90...
Between 92 and 96, we wanted to have some room for increase or decrease throughout the year.
And that's in the traditional MTW Housing Choice Voucher right. program. And then we make up the difference for Family Serves in the local programs, the SRO program, the OPRI program, sponsor-based, those programs.
Okay.
And the units that are affordable but unassisted in some of our redevelopment projects.
The reason I ask is that I know that we're good at serving the same amount of families, and we're always striving to save the amount of families. But when it says more, I'm just curious, what are our targets? And you've answered that question. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure my question was.
Yeah, and at the end of the meeting, I'm actually going to walk through a couple things in the reports to show you where we are.
Also, thank you, Dominica. I'm so glad for Commissioner Montgomery's question, because I was going to ask about the flat rent again, and I appreciate that. I was wondering if you could give me just a really quick example of what the revised, refined language is that we're talking about when it comes to arrest records and screening.
Sure.
Is it in the lease?
It is not in the lease.
Oh.
Because it's in the admin plan and in the ACOP. So in those pages that you have that should be included in the packet, it would be in those. So what we say on page...
Are you in the admin plan or the ACOP?
Right. So in the ACOP snapshot
that would be the item E?
Item E, right. On page 7... We discussed the required, the instances where there's required denial of admission. And so the language was modified to say, if you go several bullets down, in determining reasonable cause, OHA will consider all credible evidence, including but not limited to conduct underlying an arrest, any records of conviction or evictions. And so we just eliminated that arrest. Because it used to say just we will consider arrest and conviction records.
Okay.
Now what we're saying is we will consider the conduct underlying arrest. And then we also add, while OHA may not base a determination that an applicant or a household engaged in criminal activity warranting denial, termination, or eviction solely on an arrest record, it may use an arrest to trigger an investigation to determine whether the participant actually engaged in disqualifying criminal activity. So essentially what HUD and with the White House reminded housing authorities of and other property owners is that we, under fair housing law, are not allowed to deny someone solely because they have been arrested. That we have to discover if there was disqualifying criminal activity as a result of that arrest. And so we can't say because you've been arrested, you can't apply for housing with us. We have to do more due diligence to determine whether or not that family would be qualified or disqualified based on the activity of that arrest, in addition to conviction records and eviction history. And so our policy was fine before, but I think what we wanted to do was make sure that we were being very clear about our intent to further fair housing and make sure that we are offering opportunities of fair housing to everyone that it should be available to, and not, you know, not somehow being discriminatory or have a perceived angle that is not in line with what our policies are. So we had an open policy before. We really, I mean, this has come up in the past, but we have a criminal background screening process that nets out that we really have very few fails or denials at the end of the process. We have hearings, and people have a number of opportunities to be able to provide mitigating circumstances, but we wanted to just make sure that our policy is clear that we are looking not at just a sole arrest, but what the conduct was behind that arrest record. And so the language is similar to that and is placed throughout different sections of both the ACOP and the admin plan.
Thank you for that, because I know that I think our chief once said that if they get that a lot of the decisions are overturned if he just listens to the person and hears their history and finds out what really happened.
That's right. I think that...
That is right, and they should always be encouraged to attend the hearing, because if you look at the analysis of the few families who aren't getting in, they're actually not attending the hearing. They call and request it, and they don't attend.
Exactly.
And so they self-select out, which is something we really don't want people to do.
Exactly. So does the new language also extend to when people do our online pre-application? Like, is there something there that the language has changed? Because that's the first time that people...
Well, that would be the application process in the terms of the policy statement. And that would probably... We may tweak the letter. I'm not sure what we ask at that stage.
Well, what I do know is that this applies to applicants as well as participants. So
yeah.
I don't know what you...
Yeah, but in terms of the process, I'm not sure what we that we ask anything. I would have to check. What this is really just saying, I think Dominica covered it, is we really don't make a decision based on arrest. We want to state that is not the cause. An arrest alone is not, you know, you're guilty until proven innocent. So, but there may be activities around why you were arrested that we will investigate and look into. But we're never going to deny you just on an arrest.
So I don't even think we ask when we do the pre-screening application.
I don't think we do at all.
I don't think so. Okay, thank you. I was curious about the smoke-free public policy, because our RAB members had a really good discussion on the smoke-free policy. I think you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought up whether this would include marijuana smoke. So I wanted to bring it up with respect to our RAB members who had some concern.
Yes, it does.
Okay. Excellent. And how would we foster compliance?
We would evict people.
No, there must be some steps before that.
There will be the usual steps. But I'm not mincing words, because I'm serious about this. We wrote an opposition letter to this. We don't agree with this rule. We don't think you should make people homeless because they smoke. We think we should find different paths to reaching the same goal. The rule of HUD is arduous, rigorous. They opine back they didn't agree with me. And that's where we are. If the rule stands, people don't comply, they put us in a fairly untenable position. Because even though we were discussing how we could facilitate non-smoking portions of our development, take some buildings in the family developments impacted, make those non-smoking, the rule superseded our ability to do that. And one of the reasons we're doing the outreach that we're doing on this issue, and I think there's probably some people here who are showing up because of what they received in the mail regarding the issue, is to document. We really want to get input on how people are negatively impacted. We are going to try and do everything we can do for smoking cessation. But I want to be clear, if you're in a household and you have a teenager starting smoking, you're in least noncompliance.
Right.
That if you can't abate that, then we will take action, not because we are taking action against that family, but it exposes us to any lawsuits against neighboring families who could assert that they are being damaged because of the smoke and are not adhering to our own policy. So it's a very harsh policy. And the other issue, honestly, I have with it is I really hate smoking. I mean, I just want to say that for the record. The world turns you into a poster child for something that you're not necessarily wanting to be one.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate smoking, but I absolutely am appalled that HUD would consider a regulation that impacted one disenfranchised program and family and treated them in a disparate way from the other assisted programs that they administer.
Mm-hmm.
When you even say within the same program, if you're assisted from public housing and you live in Lockwood Gardens, you can be evicted because you're smoking, or you can't live there, but you can live in Lion Creek Crossing. I have problems with that.
Mm.
We're going to implement what we're required to implement, and we're going to do it in the most kind and thoughtful way we know.
Okay.
But it isn't what I would choose.
Well, I also...
And even close.
Okay. I also hate smoking. But, and I'm very curious to see whether how you said it, that we will evict you, is actually clearly stated in the documents, which I haven't read yet, in these letters. And everything that we send them, that noncompliance leads to eviction.
It's so interesting because I agree with you. And the notice, the final rule that came out, tap danced around that issue like you would not believe. And I just feel like we're doing the world a disservice. If you're, and it's passing laws that are unenforceable is the worst thing any jurisdiction can do. I shouldn't call them out, so I won't. I talked to a large housing authority in a state that has legalized marijuana.
Mm-hmm. Like this one? Oh, not this one.
Prior, 2 years ago.
Okay.
And asked how they're going to deal with that. And their response was, we passed a no smoking policy. So I asked this person, you know, this year, like, how many folks did you evict? Oh, no one. How many got noticed? Oh, no one. So they've just chosen not to enforce it. And I just think that's really bad policy. And we're doing this because we're required. If it were up to me, I'd be talking to the residents and seeing how they want to do it. I would have a path in our Section 8 portfolio to say, if you want to designate a non-smoking building, this is how many signatures you get, and we'll work to transfer if someone doesn't want to be in that, to see if we can make that a non-smoking building. In our large public housing developments, we'll take buildings and designate them smoking and buildings and designate them non-smoking. And we can easily move folks back and forth so that we can mitigate the impact primarily to children and people with health issues to keep them healthy. And that I really do support. I just don't like this rule, as Dominica's heard me go on for hours about it. And I feel like I am now. But I do think you're right, Commissioner. You want to be honest with everyone, which is why we've mailed a notice to everybody who's in an impacted unit, why we've had, I think, folks showing up tonight. Although they're not speaking, which I regret, they received mailers that this is where they could come and to get us a postcard. And I hope we do get opines, both in favor and whatever people feel. You know, I just want to get their impact. You know, we are a service agency. We're here to try and accommodate, you know, the issues that residents have in the best way. This isn't my best way, so I need to help. I need help with comments to figure out how we can make it work.
On this particular issue, and then I have one more, gosh, I hope it's not so hot issue, probably is. But so if this is a humane policy, then yes, let's do the smoke-free environment. Then we must also be humane and say, this is the smoke, this is where you can smoke. Like, I determine areas to where you can smoke. Are we doing that?
That we would love to do. Now, the rule, again, is very dictatorial. The rule has a 25-foot front.
25 feet?
We have not found
you
don't have enough
any place in any of the three large family sites or in the senior buildings, except for possibly there may be a 1 square foot in the middle of Palo Vista. We'll measure that and designate it. But here's what we're going to do in answer to your question. I'll quit being so. I just when someone, when we get dictated to such a minutia way and we don't let the communities make decisions about the health and well-being themselves, it just bothers me. And I think it bothers you, and that's why you're driving this. But what I want to say is we're going to, within the three large sites and the areas that we can try and accommodate and look at spaces, it will be a site-by-site. So at the Lockwood meeting, when we're rolling it out, we'll look and see there. If there's anywhere at Campbell, we'll have through the Campbell management meeting. At Palo Vista, the same thing. There are some seniors who adamantly don't want smoking around them, and I totally love that, but I can't. But there are other people who just are never going to be able to quit, and the solutions are not good. If we can designate spaces, though, that would help. But for example, upstairs, this is 100 seniors living upstairs, and they need to be 25 feet from the entrance of this building or either corner. And there's no room. At Del Court, there's no room. At the Oak Groves, there's no room. In Palo Vista, there may be in the middle of the Rose Garden, so we'll see if we can carve that out.
And then smoke cessation?
We'll do all that, and we are actually planning all that. And our effective date is still July 1st, 2018, correct?
That's right. So the full implementation has to happen by July 2018. So we would roll this out and then execute new leases with the tenants over the next year and a half.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's not immediate, and we'll do a big, and Greer's here, has been helping with the outreach materials, and we're going to keep pushing that, including all the cessation things that we can do, mm-hmm. different options for ingesting nicotine patches, I know,
yes.
you know, things like that, gum, try and get as many of the local programs that we have
saturated
into the communities
actually.
To help.
Yeah.
It's just an extra hardship, an extra burden, and I wish that, honestly, I wish the city would say it's you can't smoke anywhere, and we can't smoke anywhere, I'd be totally behind it. But because we're being, I think, very targeted and discriminatory
right.
against a certain group
yeah.
without any legitimate reason, it bothers me.
Thank you, Director. My final question is concerning inside of the lease agreement itself. On pages 15, and then I think once again, if I could find it quickly, maybe I can't, but there's only two instances that it mentions community service. And I know that we talked a little bit about community service. This is number page 15. It says failure to perform community service or participate in an economic self-sufficiency program in accordance with the ACOP or federal law is termination by OHA. And then I think that it also mentions it here on page 10, community service. To participate in community service in accordance with the ACOP and federal law. And that's all that's in here. And I know it's a bigger issue because our people are hardworking, et cetera. And what's behind the community service piece? And can you tell me a little bit more about that?
The community service requirement is a requirement. So that's what you see in the lease. The way it's implemented, there are several forms that the property management staff have at their disposal to be able to track and also inform residents about the details of the program. So those are not attachments to the lease, so I don't have those here, but
okay,
it
good.
Is part of the lease packet that,
oh,
that
good.
They receive.
So this isn't all that they know about it.
No,
so that
no,
was
no, no.
number one.
And the one thing about community service is who does not have to perform it.
And that's not in here.
And
so
you want to, it's yeah. if you're working, you don't have to perform it. If
right.
you're
okay.
a senior disabled, you don't have to perform it.
That's
so there's
okay.
a group of families that need
to.
And again, it's only for public housing families. Mm-hmm. It's not, Section 8 does not have, households do not have this requirement.
Okay.
And this requirement, when yeah. did they start this? It was probably 15, 12 years ago?
1999 or something like that?
Yeah, quite a while ago. And it was a similar reaction to the smoking issue we just talked about.
Exactly. How many hours do they have to do? Is this really something that staff can manage? I mean, it sounds like a huge undertaking.
No. I think it's 8 hours a month.
8 hours a month.
Yes.
And so I'm just curious that it's in here. And
it's a requirement by HUD.
It's a requirement by HUD.
That we cannot get out of as an NCW agency.
Yeah, they were so felt All so right. strongly. It's one of those things that they wouldn't give us authority to
okay.
change
yeah.
in our plan.
Well, I just wanted to tell you I noticed it. And
yeah.
I think that there are probably at least three documents that I can recall offhand that mm-hmm. the families have access to each year. It describes the community service requirement, describes the ability to be able to perform the hours all at once or stagger them throughout the months. Before there was a requirement that they had to do something every month. Now we allow families to accumulate the time.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. So there are some different, some changes in the requirement over the past year or so,
mm-hmm.
year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And the forms that the property management staff detail those changes and also then provide a way, like a report form so that they come in. There are some forms that have to be signed. We have to make sure that whether they're participants that this rule applies to or not, we have to make sure that we track it for all the households. So we go through that with each family annually as well. And that's something that we would ordinarily like to be able to stagger so that it happens at the research as well. But because it's an annual thing, we that's one of the things that we were not quite able to change yet with our standardizing of our recertification schedules with our aligned with the consent form that we're creating.
Mm-hmm.
We also wanted to do it for this, the community service requirement, but because it's annual and we can't get out of it, we still have to reach out to the families each year. So we do that on a regular basis.
So you
and we
reach out to the families, but there must be many families who say, I'm sorry I didn't get to it or I wasn't able to.
Noncompliance
perform.
Is a problem. And
right.
how many families are impacted? I don't remember what it was, but we looked at it last year. Do you recall vaguely, ballpark? Because it's only for public housing units, remember.
It's only for public housing units.
And probably, it doesn't apply to the senior disabled, so that eliminates at least three.
The senior sites are not.
Also, yeah. The streamlining rule that came out last April allowed families to self-certify, which was a big change.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay.
So do you know, from last year, approximately how many of the public housing families are subject to it? How many we have tagged? I don't either.
I don't know off the top of my head either.
Yeah.
If we include volunteering at my children's school, helping out in the community room, you know, helping with the urban gardening, sitting on the RAB, then it's like a really good incentive to promote community enrichment.
We do.
Good. So I just think it's really difficult to try to keep track of that and hold
it. It is.
Yeah.
And it's auditable by HUD. So we do keep track of it.
Well, thank you so much for your patience with me. I appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
What's that?
Can I ask another question real quick?
Yes.
Okay, getting back to the smoking policy, the question I had was, I missed the RAB meeting, and so I wasn't able to hear those comments. Are those documented?
Yes, and those comments will also be included in the final MTW plan that we submit to HUD for approval. But yes, those comments are documented in the RAB minutes, and so we probably will have them for next month's meeting.
Yeah, they get included in a table, do they not, Julie?
They get included, and if you're going to be at the RAB meeting this week, the minutes will be there, and I can just forward them to you as
well. Can I get them before
sure.
I get to
and
the
then
meeting?
For the board members,
I can forward them to you.
Any other questions or comments you want to feel free to contact us, either any of us three, and we would be happy. We'll be happy to answer those. We'll come. This will return to the board for consideration on April 3rd. I guess it's the 3rd, 4th,
right.
In April. So we still have some time. So feel free to work through it. If you have any questions, give me a call, email me, or Dominica, and we can get back to you. Tonight, the main exercise is to try and review the documents for everyone and then open it and close it for public comment so we can hear from the public. In addition, we have provided people email address. They can email comments, or they can mail them through conventional mail to the executive office, and that's all in the plan. The plan has been advertised and is also on our website, as is the ACOP and the admin plan. So they're all available electronically, and the because the smoking had such a targeted impact is why we're doing the additional outreach to those developments so that they're really informed. We really look forward to getting the postcards back. That's why they're postage paid, just so we can try and capture what the real universe is there and concerns, and then we can use that to help mitigate the impact for the families that are negatively impacted by the rule.
All right. Thank you, Director. Thank you.
So we need to.
Okay. Did we have any other questions before we move on? Did you have a question? Yes.
In regards to the changes in the language section,
sure.
In the past, in previous language, it lists certain languages, and now I notice that it stopped. Is that part is erased? So. Is it to encourage and recognize that there may be many other languages that are needed that are provided for?
We in the past, you've seen specific language referenced. We intend to identify over the next period, so before you receive the final draft of the MTW plan, we intend to identify those languages. We didn't delete them. We just want to make sure that it's consistent across programs. So what we found was that the ACOP had something different than the admin plan. And really, we should be treating language assistance the same way consistently across all our programs. So we are not deleting the languages that we identify. We just want to make sure that they're that the analysis that was performed is clear so that we can highlight whether it's Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, or if there are different dialects of any of the languages that we need to focus on based on the analysis of the data. So you will see a more detailed version of the language assistance plan come before you on the April 3rd meeting.
Okay, any more questions? I just have one. I think this will be real quick.
Okay.
What is service-enriched housing through systems
Alignment.
Sounds kind of snazzy, but...
That's whenever you want to really try and do something simple. If you give it a really thoughtful, complicated name in D.C., they really pay attention. It's like, oh, that sounds... No. That is where we take the silos of HUD, and you've seen me do this, where we have Health and Human Services, we have the Department of Labor, we have HUD, and we have education coming down in federal-funded silos, and each one of those silos are operated and enroll people independently and without coordination.
Oh, so you have like a mix valve.
Exactly. And they can't move it, but because of MTW, we can erase some of those lines. And we've come very far in terms of working with the county to do it, the THP Plus, in terms of the Homeless CalWORKs Bombs program, in terms of the OPRI program, of really trying to break down those silos so that we can integrate with the education system, with OUSD, with the county health system, and with the county welfare, and make a better package that can have better results for the families we serve. That's called systems alignment, so we're aligning the systems to better serve our people.
I totally get it, and I love that. That sounds great, so I'm really glad that I asked the question. All right, so if there's no more comments here, then we're just going on to the next.
Yeah, we need to open and close three public hearings. So the first open...
Oh, so we're finished with all of it now.
Yeah, so we're going to go through all three. We're going to start with item B. We're on item B. We're going to open and close public comment for the MTW plan.
Okay, so we have speakers, so we'll just call them for public comment.
Yeah, then, but right? First we have to, for the record, open public comment.
Right.
And then we close public comment. We have no speaker cards for the first item, but if anybody wants to speak,
right.
So if you want to call, open the public comment.
Ones we do have cards for,
and we'll get to that.
Okay.
Yeah, so let's start with item B,
so
which is the MTW plan.
For item B, we are opening public comment.
C, I'm sorry.
Or C, we are opening public comment.
And item C is public hearing on proposed Oakland Housing Authority fiscal year 2018 making transition work plan. If anyone has any comments, please step to the mic and speak your name first.
Okay, public comment is hereby closed.
We've closed public comment. Moving on to the next item.
Moving on to item D.
Item D is public hearing on proposed changes to the Oakland Housing Authority's Housing Choice Voucher Administrative Plan. I believe we have one speaker card. Anyone else in the audience who would like to address the commission and make any comments is welcome to do so. Please state your name first.
We are open for comments.
And I think the one card, I think, is an issue that's for that.
Item D, I believe, is Javon Saucer. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Yes, into the mic,
please.
And again, just state your name, and you'll get 3 minutes to speak.
Hi, I'm Javon Saucer. I'm not really good at speaking in public, so if I stutter or anything, please forgive me. I got this letter about the smoking thing. It just came in the mail today, so that's probably why nobody else is here to talk about it, mm-hmm. because we just got it with 6 hours left to come here. I don't know if anybody knows this, but there is no spot that's 25 feet away from the buildings, mm-hmm. except for on East 14th, if you live in 65th. There's one spot. It's in the middle of the street in the back. It's a little island where a five-year-old boy was murdered. Nobody stands there because that boy died there. Out of respect for him, we don't stand there. That's the only spot. And in the time that I've lived there, I'm 30 now. I've been living there since I was in junior high school. I was homeless in junior high school, and then we got in there. In this time, I've seen several people murdered standing around outside on 65th. A bullet has come past my own head at night when I was walking to my brother's car. If we're to stand outside to smoke, then we might as well just put a sign on us that says, hey, I'm ready to duck bullets today. Because you can easily get shot just because you want to have a cigarette outside your house. And what about wintertime? In the winter, we got to stand outside in the cold to smoke a cigarette. If you want to smoke a cigarette at night, let's say you woke one in the morning. I know a lot of y'all don't smoke, and I applaud y'all for that. It's not healthy. If you wake up in the middle of the night and you want to have a cigarette, should you have to walk over 30 feet away from your front door in a neighborhood where people shoot and rob people just to have a cigarette? I don't think that's right. Like, they don't do that with any other thing. If you want to have a sip of alcohol, they don't make you walk out of your house to drink. They tell you it's better to drink in your house than outside, because it is. And it is the same for anything else that you want to do that you could do in your house. If you live in a neighborhood where people shoot, if you want to do something, it's better that you do it in your house because there is a chance that you can catch a bullet. There is a chance you can get robbed. Last year, a young white man came, a white boy that was around 14 years old. He was walking through the village and somebody snatched his phone out of his hand and ran off. He went to my father and said, "Somebody just robbed me. Help me. I don't know what to do." My father walked him to the front office so he could call the police and make a report on that. Bad things happen there. They say that they put up a lot of cameras. That is a lie. I would invite any of y'all to come to 65th and look around. Look on all the buildings. There's cameras on the main building. Nowhere else. Come at night. Look in the parking lot. See how there's no lights in the parking lot. Okay. It's pitch black. You walk outside in the lot, you got to have a flashlight to put your key in your car. It seems at this point kind of an easy spot to get hurt, especially if you have to go outside for something as simple as to smoke a cigarette when you could do it in your own house. If we're smoking outside, then kids are going to see us smoking outside. If we smoke in our house, no kids have to watch that. No kid has to think, hey, that's cool.
So this is 65th and International?
It's Lockwood Gardens.
Yes.
It's Lockwood Gardens. Okay.
So first I want to thank you for coming down. Your time's up. Okay. For speaking, but I'd also like to move the comments to the next item for the record, so they considered in the right one. I misnumbered it for the chair.
All right.
And I want to thank you for coming down. It's important that we get the comments both to and from. In terms of the timing, you can let any of your neighbors know, and certainly you've come and spoken, so we'll put this in the record. Anyone can email us, they can call us, or they can handwrite us or fill out the postcard. So we can put it into the plan by the first week in April. So there's dates on getting that to us. I think they have to be to us by what date? March 16th. So there's some time left for people to email us and just get the comments. So if you have neighbors who are concerned more than just you, please have them email us. That's the purpose of why we did the outreach. And I really appreciate you coming.
Javon, what's your last name?
Saucer.
How do you spell that?
S-A-U-C-E-R.
S-A-U-C-E-R?
Yes.
I'm really concerned about the lighting.
Yeah,
I am. Poor lighting. I'm really concerned about that comment.
They've put new bulbs in a couple of times, and mm-hmm. then a week later, somebody comes around and breaks them, and nobody does nothing.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for that comment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, Yvonne, I also want to thank you for coming, because what you've told us, I think, is important. I mean, you've highlighted a couple of really important issues about this, and I think that everyone here is going to be happy to be aware of that. So thank you very much for your time and providing your input. We really appreciate it, because this is our job, you see, and when you come in and talk to us like that, you help us become more accountable. Yeah. I mean, sometimes we can't always solve the problem, because sometimes we're under the gun from people that are above us, and as Eric was saying earlier, there's certain things that we can't say no to, right? Mm-hmm. But what we can do is do what we can.
Yeah.
So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you.
So if there's anyone else who wants to make comments on the administrative plan for the Section 8 program, I think that's it.
Okay, I think that's it.
Yeah.
So therefore, we are now closing comments on item D. Hope I'm not losing track of the letters
You're right.
here. We are now closing comments on item D, which is changes to the Housing Authority's Housing Choice Voucher Administrative Program. We will now be opening public comment on proposed changes to the Oakland Housing Authority's public housing admissions and continued occupancy policy. Well, I said all
that. And we'll consider the previous comments under this item, and I believe we have one more speaker card.
And we do. We have one other speaker card. Looks like Nathaniel Speed Lavette. Speed Lavetta. Speed and Lavetta. Oh. Nathaniel.
And anyone else who would like to speak on the item, please step forward and just state your name before your comments.
I'm Mrs. James, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my neighbor, Mrs. Speed. I don't have your agenda, so I don't know if it's... So I don't know if my comment is pertaining to what's on your agenda. I'm here because I'm a longtime resident of Harrison Towers, and so is Mrs. Speed. And my, I don't want to seem uncooperative or resistant, but I'm protesting the rent has to be in hand by the 5th. I get my Social Security on the 3rd. It can't get through the mail to Massachusetts in 2 days. You know that. I don't have to tell you that. But that is my protest and Mrs. Speed. We think it's unrealistic to expect us to have your rent in the mail and in your office by the 5th.
Thank you for your comment. In order to just capture your comment a little bit better, what, how many days do you think we should provide in the ACOP?
Well, if I'm getting Social Security on the 3rd, I've always had trouble with the Postal Service. I would say a minimum of 5 days.
So that would be the 8th.
So you, oh, the 8th? Okay.
Yes.
Is that unreasonable? Is that what your comment is? What we want to get is your advice on how we could make the change.
I would say the 8th or the 10th. Because okay. Some people do have retirement, and they get it on the 1st.
Yeah.
My retirement is less than my Social Security. That is my complaint. My largest income is Social Security on the 3rd.
Thank you. That's a terrific comment, and
yes,
we'll take it under consideration.
Thank you.
Yes, again, thank you very much for bringing that to our attention, because that's the timing of fixed income payments.
Yes.
And really, that is kind of like a big deal.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very, very good comments tonight. Okay, hearing or seeing no more speakers, we will now close public comment on the public housing admissions and continued occupancy policy. And that means we will now move on to item F. Wow, another big deal.
Item F is kind of a big deal. You'll bear with us, so we're going to switch over. Item F is the presentation and acceptance of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or the CAFER, for the Oakland Housing Authority for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2016, and that was included and it's bound in your packet. The CAFER is more than just the audit, but it includes all of the audit, and I'm pleased to first note that we are one of three housing authorities in the country to be awarded excellence in financial reporting for 3 years in a row.
And, keep the roll and going.
Well, they do our best, and I want to also introduce Tracy Stabler, our chief financial officer, who oversees all of our financial operations and the audits and the successful audits we've had in recent years. So, Tracy, do you want to walk us through? It's a kind of a confusing document, and the other thing I want to offer all the board members as well, is if you'd like to have time with Tracy to kind of go over and understand what it is more than what we present today, feel free to give us a call and we'll arrange a time. So Tracy, take it away.
Okay, if you'll just give me a second, I'm trying to make this so everyone can
see. She's going to walk us through the document, and we thought because to walk us through, she's going to walk you through the actual document, and so the audience and all could see what she's looking at.
Oh, okay.
She's going to show us, and some of it is surreal. Until you read it. And we want to be just honestly as out there with it as we can so people understand it.
Is that a currently vogue financial term?
Yes, surreal is. It's, we're defining it in our new OMB circular, I think.
Good evening. Tracy Stabler, Chief Financial Officer. First, I want to give you a little background. Under federal requirements, HUD requirements, we are required to have an audit in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles, what is known as GAAP. In order to do that, we hire an external auditor. Macias Guinea O'Connell is our external. They come in every year for the last 4 years to audit our books. They're required to follow standards called generally accepted auditing standards. Because we do receive federal monies, we're also held to a higher standard, so they must also follow what's called generally accepted government auditing standards, which requires a more in-depth testing and reporting of what they have seen when they've looked at our books and other activities. We have elected also to, in addition to issuing just our basic financial statements, which is what GAAP requires, we go with the Government Finance Officers Association, which puts out a standard for the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or CAFR. That gives you both the basic financial statements, which are statements and footnotes and required supplementary information, but it also asks us to provide you more. So I'm going to just walk you through the table of contents, give you an overview, and then we'll start at the beginning and kind of walk through some of the sections of the CAFR, as well as I'll point out just some highlights. So if you have questions as you've reviewed some of this, please feel free to interrupt at any time and ask those as we go along. So if you look on the table of contents, it breaks it down basically into four major sections: the introductory section, the financial section, the statistical section, and the federal compliance section. So the federal or the introductory section just introduces a letter to the board to give you an overview of what we're going to present in the CAFR itself. It is also then followed by a basic outline of what our structure looks like. It tells you what our organization chart looks like, what our Board of Commissioners structure looks like, and then what our executive team structure looks like. I would like to kind of point out to you on page Roman numeral 5, and I'm just going to catch everyone up here. This is something we received from the GFOA called the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting, and that's what Executive Director Johnson was mentioning, that we submit this every year to the GFOA body, and they have it reviewed, and if we comply with all the parts of it, they will issue this certificate. So I am proud to say we did receive it for last fiscal year, the third year out of the 3 years that we've submitted for it. So we look forward to doing that. I've already submitted the fiscal 16 that we're reviewing today, and we'll have comments back over that over the summer. And if it's successful, another certificate. Then following the next section is going to be the financial section. The financial section is what is comprises our most basic financial statements. It is comprised of the auditor's opinion, followed by the management's discussion and analysis, which is primarily an executive summary.
Could you please tell us pages as you go along? So
right.
We can catch up.
What I'm doing now is just giving you an overview, and then we'll start at the beginning and kind of walk through it. So the financial section has the audit opinion, the management discussion and analysis, which is an executive summary of what the whole financial is. It tells you what the activity more or less compared to the prior year was. And then it gives you a kind of a more progressive outlook on what we foresee going to happen and how it will be impacting the next year's financials. Then it is followed by the financial statements themselves, which you're required to have three: the statement of net position, which is your balance sheet; the statement of revenues, expenses, and changes of net position, which is the income statement; and then the statement of cash flows. Following that is notes to the financial statement that gives you basic policies and outlines anything that could be interpreted as differences in GAAP, where you have an opinion, will tell you what decision we made and how we're following it and sometimes why. And then finally, the last section is the required supplementary information, and those are additional schedules that are more comprehensive. In our case, we're required to supplement the information on our pension plan and our other post-employment benefit plans. So those schedules are included in the financial section. The next section is the statistical section. This section is giving you more of a historic outlook. It gives you, where possible, 10 years worth of the same data on various financial elements, our net positions, sometimes our revenues, different elements of our revenues. It gives you demographic information. It's a very good resource on how the agency has been behaving over a 10-year period. And then the last section is our federal compliance section. In there, we give you the schedule of expenditures of federal awards, which explains where we received our federal funds from, with a footnote on how we account for them. And then it also has a schedule of if there were any findings during the audit and what those findings were, as well as the two opinions that our external auditors issue on how we comply with both the government auditing standards, as well as what used to be called the A-133 Single Audit Act, which is now known as the Uniform Guidance. So that is the basic outline of the CAFR itself. So I'm going to leave you to read the introductory section yourself, but kind of just start with the financial section. So if you would start on page one of the financial, that is the opinion by the external auditors, MGO, standing for Macias Guinea O'Connell. They are reporting in this report on the financial statements themselves. They give you a background of what their responsibility is, what our responsibility is. And then on page two, I'd like to bring to your attention the section at the top called opinions. And this is the meat of what their testing is, where they tell you that in their opinion, they feel that our financial statements are fairly represented in accordance with GAAP. That's considered an unmodified, the highest opinion you could have. It's not qualified in any way, and they had no significant changes or recommendations to make regarding the financials. So we're very proud of that.
Yeah, for anyone that's not out of the finance world, that's a big deal.
Exactly.
It's a pretty bad thing to have a qualified opinion. It's a real good thing to have.
Exactly. So, again, as I had mentioned, the next section of the financial section is the management's discussion and analysis. I'm going to leave that for you as the executive summary because we're going to go into detail on the financial statements themselves. So if you go over to page 11, this is the first statement, which is the statement of financial position. Our financials are prepared in accordance with government accounting standards. The Government Accounting Standards Board, or GASB, is our governing body that dictates what generally accepted accounting principles are. One of the things they require is that we present both our primary government, which is the left-hand column, so that is all the activities of Oakland Housing Authority itself, as well as its two blended component units, which are two nonprofits that meet the requirements to be included into our financial statements. The column on the right is the discretely presented component units, and these are various affiliates and partnerships with which we do business that, while we don't control them and the rules don't include they be put it in our financials, they're so closely related to us that it would be misleading not to include them, so we're required to give you that information as a separate column. Most of these you'll recognize as a lot of our mixed finance properties and partnerships, and it's just that they have different investors and different boards and different bodies that rule them. So while we're interrelated and we have a lot of financial activities, we actually don't govern their actual entities. Tassafaronga, the Chestnut, Linden, all of those, yes. Just a couple items to point out briefly. There's the assets. We have current assets as well as non-current assets. Current assets are about $163 million. The non-current assets come to about $226 million, with total assets being about $389 million. I will get back to the section called deferred outflows in a second. The section of the financial statement is the liabilities. We have, again, current and non-current. Our current liabilities are about $10 million, and our non-current about $2 million. So total liabilities amount to about $12 million. Based on the rules of government accounting, your net position is generally the difference between your assets and your liabilities. So as you can see at the bottom of the page, total net position is $377 million, of which $118 million of that is represented by being invested in our capital assets, our building stock, our improvements, and our equipment, and et cetera. And then
all of that capital stock that regarding buildings and all that, that is at historical cost. It hasn't been adjusted in any way.
It's recorded at historic cost and then depreciated over the life. So it's the net book value after it's been depreciated. So if our housing stock is depreciated over 40 years, it could be partially depreciated, or it could be at a net value of zero right now if it's older.
I see. So as public entities, we depreciate those assets even though we don't pay taxes.
Correct. Correct.
I wonder why we do
well,
that.
Well, the depreciation isn't just a taxable purpose. It's also to represent the fact that
wear and tear, right.
It diminishes over
right.
time. So.
And are these discretely presented component units? Is that breaking out a subset of the main column, or are those two columns additive to one another?
They're additive.
Okay, cool.
They're separate. So the last thing I'll point out on the balance sheet is, as you may recall, last year we implemented GASB 68, which is the pension reform standards. And at the time we were... just prior to that, the board had authorized us to start funding our pension plan in such a way to minimize the liability at the time. So this year is the second year of the implementation, and I just want to show you the components of what makes up that pension liability. So about in the middle of the page is the line called deferred outflows of resources for $4.1 million. What that represents is because our pension standards now require us to report based on what CalPERS releases, the information they give us is a year old. So this information is based on CalPERS valuation as of 6/30/2015. So the $4.1 million represents the monies we put into the pension plan since that valuation date. So these are the contributions we've made that will get rolled into expense next year. About two-thirds of the way down, there is under non-current liabilities, the second line under that is the net pension liability itself, which is $392,000. And that's the total pension liability less the market value of the pension assets that the plan CalPERS is holding on our behalf. And then finally, the component called deferred inflow pension items is $3.6 million, and what that represents is differences between what was projected in their valuation and what came to pass during that 1 year since they had made the valuation. So if you put those together, really what comes down to is our net pension liability is almost non-existent. We have more than enough in the deferred outflows of 4.1 to cover the liability and any of these deferred outflows. So
would it be accurate to say that OHA really does not have any unfunded liabilities lying out there?
Correct. Right now, you'll see further in the footnotes, we are funded at less than one or more. We are unfunded at about 1.3%.
for the pension,
so that's
right?
Like pensions, health care.
No, I think it's just pension.
This is just the pension
plan. The other ones, there are deficits we're doing the same thing we've done in the past.
Right.
And we will be back, which
right.
is the
right.
message.
Right, okay, yeah.
So once we get the analysis from CalPERS, one of the things we've been very, I think, successful at doing is making sure that we keep the unfunded liability, and meaning how much deficit we would have in our pension and our medical and our post-retirement benefits as whole as we can. Because some of the actuarials have changed in terms of how they're calculated, there will be some more, and we'll be back probably in the next 3 to 5 months with that once we get the report from CalPERS. One of the things that's really important that separates us in many ways from different forms of government is we have no general fund. We live and breathe this year based on how much resources we bring in and what our expenses are. It's a pay-as-you-go system. And that's kept us fairly in good stead with this issue once we started making the payments to make up the deficit. But if the world were to change dramatically tomorrow and there was not a housing authority, which is not in this crazy world necessarily inconceivable, and I think we've learned that everything is possible, the liability of that goes on to the employees who have worked here for the past 70, 80 years. And we have employees that have been with us 40 years. So they do have a retirement, and it is part of their payment and pension, and making sure that that is whole is really important. Unlike
yes.
a city that will definitely continue, unlike a city that can do local taxes and otherwise make up for it, we're not that agency, and we feel very strongly that we want to make sure we pay as we go. That if we have debts and obligations under what we have to report with, and we work through CalPERS, we want to pay those so that we're as whole as we possibly can be, so that we can preserve the retirements of our
yes,
employees.
Yes, and actually, that was the nature of my question, really. So there are no, we don't know of any 300-pound unfunded gorillas in the room.
Well,
yes, we do.
No, we do. Okay. Never mind, then.
And
we
we'll get to that in
now.
A subsequent
okay.
meeting once we have the analysis.
Okay.
But Tracy and I do know of one.
Okay. All right. Good.
Well, I would point out, too, as you may recall, back in April of last year, we came to the board and said you had previously given us permission to pre-fund the pension plan yeah. in anticipation of this. We also know that as of 6/30/2018, a similar standard is coming out for the post-retirement health benefit plan. So we asked the board at the time if we could start funding that, and you gave us permission. If you look on non-current assets, about the fourth line down, there is net OPEB assets of $3.5 million. That's the first year of us starting to fund that so that we can address that liability when it hits in fiscal 18.
Yeah, because, you know, I mean, I just think that with the times and everything that's cooking right now, dealing with these things is a good idea. I mean, mm-hmm. right? I mean.
And we've been very, very, yeah. very fortunate to be able to have the resources the past few years to,
yeah.
to do this.
Right.
And, you know, I think that, and I just want to say, that's in good testament to the staff and the people who put in the work to turn our programs around in a way that they are well-run, cash-flowing in a really positive way. And this is one of the reasons that they're here, and I want to make sure we can protect them. So, and I do think we have a real obligation, because I would hate to be caught in a situation where you're suddenly told, and it wouldn't be by me, but by somebody else sitting in this chair, that you've got to sell Harrison Towers to pay for this unfunded liability. And that is literally what could happen across this country if other housing authorities don't take care of this issue. And I would tell you that from our experience in a recent group of MTW housing authorities, Tracy was discussing how we handled this in the program, and faces fell because they all realized that they hadn't done their, they were in a position that was dangerous.
Right, and that's actually, you know, I mean, again, everybody's got different levels of financial background and understanding, but I mean, these are the kinds of issues that have bankrupted cities. I mean, they've put people, I mean, this can be big time catastrophic if it's not attended to. And what Eric just said is really on the money, because it's really the good work that everybody has done to be able to make funding this important stuff possible, because this is not glamorous. You know, this is not like we can go out and say, hey, look at this cool new building we built. But what we can say is, hey, we have taken care of the future lives of our employees, right? And I think that's a really cool and important thing.
Oh, anywhere, as we go through, if you have a question on where we are, ask it now.
I just have clarification questions. Yeah. Prepaid expenses. Prepaid expenses.
Prepaid expenses are primarily where we pay all of our insurance up front.
Insurance up front.
And then some of our larger, like our software licenses that last for a year, and then we write it off over the year.
Okay, the unearned revenues.
Unearned revenues are monies that we have received from HUD that we have not yet fully performed what they've asked us to do. So we don't recognize it as revenue because it's in the liability section, because if we fail to perform, we may have to pay it back. Okay. But we don't anticipate that.
Okay. And then two more questions. The family self-sufficiency deposits, I didn't...
Yes,
what's that?
So Lenita, Director Lenita Wheeler, and her Family and Community Partnership Group runs the program for family self-sufficiency, and as they engage the participants in the plan to work out a plan to improve their situation, we start depositing in accordance with the plan contributions on their behalf, so that when they graduate from the program, they're giving these funds to accomplish whatever task, whether they're going to make a down payment on a house or buy a car, et cetera. So as they earn it every month, we're required to restrict those monies to make sure we have them available to pay, and that represents the liability.
Okay, and then I had another question. Okay, I just had just clarification question. On the tenant security deposits, that's a lot of money in there.
We have a lot of tenants.
Yeah, yes. I mean, but what do we, I mean, the money's in there.
Yes, just, the money is there, and as they move out, we refund.
We give it back to them.
That, or we apply it towards unpaid rents or damages, however, in accordance with the local law.
Okay, that's it.
So the last thing I would point out on the balance sheet is under the primary government column, the left-hand column, under non-current assets, you'll see there are notes receivable from component units of about $71 million. I just want to relate that down to the discretely presented component unit column, the right-hand column, under non-current liabilities, and there is long-term debt due to primary governments of $72 million. There's technical reasons why the numbers don't match, but I just want to point the relationship that most of those receivables are due from these discretely presented component unit affiliates that we have relationships with. Okay. So on page 13 is the income statement. So we generally break that into operating revenues less the operating expenses, and then any other non-operating activities, be they revenues or expenses, that impact our financial activity for the year. This is, again, broken into primary government and the discretely presented component units. I think, as you can see, our largest component is our housing assistance revenues that come in, $674 million, which is approximately 93% of all of our revenues. And that is followed by the rental income, which is actually the income from the tenants themselves. Miscellaneous revenue, the largest part of that $16 million is one of our blended component units, California Affordable Housing Initiatives, or CAHI. Their relationship with their with the contract with HUD is they receive a large piece of housing assistance payment, so the subsidy is in there, but they also receive an administrative fee, and the large bulk of it, about $14.5 million of that $16 million, represents the fees we receive for CAHI. Other miscellaneous is developer fees, ground leases. We have some relationships with some parking lots where we receive income, and a couple other items. But as you can see, it's mostly our housing assistance. Our operating expenses, again, the largest piece is the housing assistance payments out to the landlords, $630 million, followed by, you know, maintenance and operations of our public housing sites, $15 million. And then the general expenses of $12 million are in relation to the activity with CAHI. They have a very large contract to help manage that, and they pay about $10 million out. And then the rest of that is insurance costs is what represents the general expenses. Non-operating, as you can see, gain on disposal of assets. We did sell a few properties this year, and that represents the funds that came in. And then the income loss before capital. For the primary government, there is no capital contribution, so our income loss was about $6.2 million. I would point out that that is GAAP accounting, so that's our revenues less the expenses that report on the income statement. We also spend money that doesn't show up on the income statement when we buy capital assets, when we fund things like our OPEB plan or our pension plan, or when we loan notes to our development affiliates. So those expenditures of cash do not show up in this number, so we actually have spent more than that over and above the revenue. Did anyone have questions on the income statement?
That would be cash flow, right?
That would be cash flow. Okay. So then on the next page is the cash flow statement. It is presented in two different ways. We're required to present the direct method of the cash flow, which literally tells you where all of our cash comes from, tenants, the different customers, our housing assistance, et cetera, and then it is followed by what we have spent it on, primarily housing assistance, our vendors for goods and supplies, and other grant payments out. And then, as I pointed out, cash flow from our capital and related activity. As you can see, we spent almost $13 million this year on capital improvements and purchases, which is the renovation of our housing stock mostly. The second piece of the cash flow statement is on page 15, and that's the indirect, and that literally just tells you how you get from the change in cash on the balance sheet from year to year, whether we paid down our accounts payables, whether we increased our receivables, how did those balances on the balance sheet, the non-cash balances, impact the cash itself.
Ms. Tracy, so these two pages sort of go together. So are you using the same money? Because I need to get
yes,
it really simple.
Yes, it is so, two methods of presenting the same activity.
Money.
Yes.
So the housing assistant payment revenues at $674 million is somewhere in here, like in the $698 million?
Yes, exactly.
So
exactly.
Why are those numbers different?
They're different because when we are due to receive the money, I accrue it. So it might be a receivable on the balance sheet. So I might recognize the fact that I'm supposed to receive $674 million. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, last year at 6/30, HUD owed us about $11 million. So they paid it to us in cash this year. So I received more cash than I actually recognized in the year. So.
Okay.
That's the difference. That's why they have you look at a cash flow. The other two statements are prepared on the accrual basis.
But that $11 million didn't identify itself as a lump sum. You just put it into the 698.
Right. Well, we recognized it because when we received it, we knew it was reducing the receivable as opposed to going into the revenue account.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the next piece of the financial section is the footnotes. So the footnotes are supposed to enhance those statements that we just looked at, the balance sheet, income statement, and cash flows. It always starts with two footnotes that are required. The first one is the organization, so it tells you who the housing authority is and what we're made up of. It tells you the different programs that comprise our activities, and then it talks about who is the reporting entity itself. So starting on page 18 at the bottom, the reporting entity describes what we are as a housing authority, and then on the next page, it describes the two blended component units that I mentioned earlier, the two nonprofits that are required to be incorporated in the primary government financials. Then it goes on to describe each one of the district component units. So this is where you'll see the familiar names of all of our partnerships that we are engaged with in our mixed finance projects. The next required footnote is footnote number 2 that starts on page 24. And what that does is describe to you all of the major accounting policies that go into making up those financial statements. When there is a choice, it will tell you, such as depreciation method. There are several out there, so we describe to you what method we use so that it helps understand how we're calculating things in the financial statements. It also describes some of the requirements that we may have changed. So as of last year, we had on page 26, we start talking about the new pronouncement. So it describes anything that has changed during the year or might change in the upcoming year to tell you how we're going to handle it. So the next footnotes, starting at number page 28, number 3, this just starts going through components of the financial statements themselves, starting literally at the top of the balance sheet, which is cash, and it starts telling you any major item of significance that you may want to pay attention to. So if we have cash, some of it is restricted. So here it will tell you about the family self-sufficiency escrows and the fact that we have to restrict the cash for that, tenant security deposits, et cetera. So we can describe why we're restricting it and how much in the financials themselves. It also, going through just picks other items, how we hold our cash, what different bank accounts, whether we have investments, et cetera. Footnote number 4 is starting on page 29, and that is, the description of the cash. It's just major components of the financial statements. Footnote number 5 on page 31 talks about our notes receivable and the components of that. That's followed by detailed descriptions on each entity we have a note receivable from and what the terms are. Mm-hmm. Correct. That is primarily going to pertain to our discretely presented component units. Any bank account under the Dodd-Frank Act is covered by the government up to $250,000. So if you have an account that has more than that and the bank was to crash, you would only be able to recoup $250,000. So there's a risk that you could lose any difference. We as a government, though, actually have government accounts with our bank, and they're required to be collateralized, which means that they can't invest them in any of the more risky reserve investments that they use. They actually have to have it fully collateralized against our balance. So we don't have the risk that our discrete component units do, but we are required to disclose it under GAAP, so that footnote is there. No, because they're limited partnerships. They're not a government. But we also monitor them very closely to make sure that they're... If you go to page 11, the discrete component unit cash is $4.4 million. No, that's what they have that is not protected as a government account. there's a lot of ways you can mitigate risk. It's the same as our own accounts. If any of us had 250 or 300,000 to invest, ours would be exposed also. So you mitigate that by saying, am I going to put this in a bank that I know nothing about, or am I going to use a bank with a good rating? I'm going to do my homework and say, you know, have they ever failed to return deposits? You know, there is definitely a system in the financial institutions that that report on their failures, their reserves, and whether they've actually you know, had any claims on their FDIC. You can get online and look at that. So this footnote is just bringing to your attention that there could be a risk, but then they also, it's up to each partnership to mitigate that risk and say whether that is, you know, the 4.4 million is in a myriad. We have probably 13 discrete component units, so each one of them is a different entity and also receives the insurance, and each different bank you're with covers 250, so you can spread your risk by having it in more than one bank. Okay.
So total we have 4.2 million.
4.4 million.
They're spread across 13 different?
13 no. different entities, okay. And then you would have to go and get more information on how many bank accounts that is in also. Okay. Mm-hmm. So then note five, again, was talking about our notes receivable and interest receivable with our discrete component units and the different terms of that. It goes from page 32 over to page 35 and describes all the different notes, actually over to 37, sorry, and describes each one in full detail. Note six is a summary of the activities for our capital assets, any of our additions for the year, as well as anything we've disposed of, and the depreciation associated with it. And then at the bottom of page 38 is note seven regarding our long-term obligations. I think we as an agency is very proud that we keep our liabilities relatively low, so our biggest obligation in the long term is our compensated accrued vacation for our staff, which is due to be paid to them at either termination or retirement, so we account for that. Note eight goes into a little more descriptive detail of what our risk management policies are, the type of insurance we cover, the type of claims we have, and then the bigger footnote that everybody has a hard time reading because this is the new one is starting on page 40 is note 10, which is our pension, our defined benefit pension plan. The new GASB that was enacted last year, implemented last year, gave very specific instructions on what this footnote contains. So it tells you basically what the plan is comprised of, who is eligible for it, what the different terms are, the vesting, the payout benefits, how many people are in the plans. We have two different plans, one for our non-sworn officers, the miscellaneous plan, and then the different safety plan for our sworn officers. It also goes into how the valuation was done to calculate what the pension liability is, and then what our liability is. It also then continues with information on how CalPERS actually invests the funds and the type of plan they put the monies into on our behalf.
I think this question is outside of where we're at, but do we have earthquake insurance on our properties or some kind of, what is it called? Natural disaster type of insurance?
I would defer that to Ms. Artesia Dupree, our risk manager.
And she actually was here earlier, but I think she just stepped away. So we'll get you an answer to that question.
Okay, thank you.
No, that would be rolled into our overall insurance. It wouldn't be called out separately. And the question is it included in the high group insurance? And if so, what coverage do we have?
No, no, that would be in our either, I don't think it would be commercial liability. I think it would be our property.
Mr. Pree has re-entered the room, and the question for Artesia, if you can answer it, is does our insurance coverage cover any earthquake damage to our property?
We do have earthquake coverage under our general liability policy.
So what our risk manager, Mr. Pree, just said is we do have earthquake coverage under our risk.
Our general liability
with the high group.
We don't have flood coverage.
But we don't have flood coverage, which could be an issue in the changing times. But if the water comes down, we're covered. If the water goes up, we're not. That's the problem.
Thank you.
Okay. So on page 44, you will find continuing the pension footnote. It's a very long one. Really starts breaking out exactly what the components of the calculation of the net pension liability is. As I would like to point out, we're so proud of the fact that our net pension liability is less than $500,000. It's at less than $300,000. So I think we are very proud and intend to continue that. And then the next footnote is number 11, which is the other post-employment benefit, also known as the retiree health care. That is the one right now. The standard requires that we disclose the liability and pay the premiums as you go. We are not required to pay into any annual required amount. But as long as we pay the premiums for the retirees in the year they're due, that's all the standard requires. As of 6/30/18, that will be changing. And again, you're going to see a footnote. As long as footnote 10 for the pension will be as long for note 11, the OPEB footnote, because we'll be required to actually have an actuarial valuation that estimates what the total liability is, and we'll be required to put that on our balance sheet. Again, our plan is to funded in such a way that we'll have little or no liability to report on the balance sheet. Okay, and then note 12, the next two footnotes, note 12 followed closely by note 13. Note 12 is commitments and contingent liabilities. So these aren't actual liabilities that we're required to report in the financial statements because we only have to pay them in the eventuality that they occur. So these are things where we give some of our affiliates guarantees. So we're required to tell you that those types of liabilities are there, but unless our affiliate fails in some way to meet their terms, then we'd be required to take it over and pay the liability as agreed. That is followed closely by note 13, which is the related parties to whom we might have these arrangements with. Again, they're mostly those reported in the column for discretely presented component units, and they're all of our mixed finance deals where each one describes some of the things we do, whether we have leases with them, whether we have operating guarantees or deficits, if there are other types of conduit debt that we've helped them issue. It describes it in full detail. And then on page 53 is actually it's page 52. This is an expanded version of that discretely presented component unit column on our financial statement. So this tells you all the different affiliates and their individual pieces of the assets, liabilities, operating revenues, and expenses. So it just gives you an expanded version of that column. Well, the operating losses really amount to a lot of these affiliates are tax credit projects. So the benefit of their existence is that they're providing the affordable housing while also providing tax shelters to the affiliates. So they're anticipated to operate at those because they're generating losses for the partnership. That's why they invested in them. So it's usually because you're also going to always have large capital assets that are going to depreciate, and the depreciation is a non-cash expense, so you'll have a large loss to the extent that these assets are being written off. Right. Well, they generally do. Well, these are not nonprofits. These are actually limited partnerships, but they're designed to operate in this way. Like I said, they are actually for-profit entities, the investors, who take those losses and write them off on their tax returns. So, okay. Because they're a blended component unit, they're not a discretely presented component unit. And and we'll get back to that one in a minute. To finish note 14, the summarized or expanded financial is followed by more footnotes that describe the different things, the different reserves they have, their the long-term obligations, and some of their other major, you know, footnotes that similar to how we've disclosed them in our footnotes. And then getting back to your comments, starting on page 57 is a summary information of our blended component unit. So you will actually see OPI and CAHI there with their financial information. And so the last piece of the financial section is the required supplementary information. As I had mentioned earlier, this is required information according to GASB that gives you a more detailed calculation of how we arrived at the net pension liability. That's on page 61. And then it discusses in a little more detail the schedule of the contributions we've made and the different methodology we use to actually complete the actuarial valuation, or the assumptions that went into valuing the actual liability itself. And then the second required piece of information is on page 64, which is our OPEB plan. This is the old methodology that will change in 2 years, but we're required to tell you what our schedule of funding progresses, and it goes by every 2 years, which is when the valuation was prepared for the OPEB plan. Were there any questions on the notes themselves? Okay. The next section is other supplementary information, and it's just an expanded version of the financial statements for the primary government. So these just tell you how it breaks out into a little more detail. Each column gets expanded a little more. So starting on page 67, you'll see the federal programs, other housing programs, and general programs. And then the total will actually articulate back to page 11 of the balance sheet. If you go over to page 72, this combining schedule just takes that federal column and expands it out and gives you detail by each federal program itself. And then on page 76, this is the other housing program column, and it just expands out what the different, it's mainly our two blended component units and some of our other housing. So the next section is the statistical section. And just to briefly, as I mentioned, these are different components of the financials that you've been looking at tonight. It just gives you 10 years worth of information. So it gives you a nice comparison, mostly of our either our net position or our financial activities. For example, on page 81, there is our income statements for the last 10 years. So it gives you a kind of a historic look over what's been happening. Another section I like to point out is page 90 gives you a breakdown for the last 10 years of what our inventory our housing inventory looked like for the last 10 years. And then the next page gives you a 10-year look back over what our waiting list activity has looked like. So it's got a lot of useful trending information to be able to look like and see how we've operated over the last 10 years. The last section I want to bring to your attention is the federal compliance section. As I had mentioned earlier, the generally accepted government auditing standards requires that we have a little bit more expanded testing. So instead of just testing the balances, what they look at is also our internal controls over how we capture the data and how we control the income and expense and balance sheet activities over a period of the year that they're looking at. They also are required to look at us and make sure that we are in compliance with all laws and regulations, things that might have a material impact on our financial statements. So starting at page 95 is Macias's report on the government audit standards. So on page one, they're talking about the internal control. What this report does is that they don't give you an assurance that we have nothing wrong. They just tell you that they didn't find anything. So they go in and say, we looked to see if you had any problems with controls, but we didn't see anything. It is on page 95, the section that says internal controls over financial reporting. And it's about the last paragraph, and it says, given these limitations during our audit, we did not identify any deficiencies in internal controls. So they kind of tell you they didn't see anything, but that doesn't mean it's not there. But that's the best they'll give us. That's pretty much what it is. When they come in, they actually have extensive memos over each one of our transaction cycles. So they say, how do you receive cash? How do you write your checks? How do you calculate, your prepaid? We tell them each section how we do it. And then they go in and make sure that we're performing it as we say we are.
Yeah, right.
Correct. Exactly. So then the second piece of that report is on page 96, where they have to say whether they found us in noncompliance with any laws or regulations that could be material. And in this circumstance, they did not. The next and final report that the auditors are required is under the Uniform Guidance or the Single Audit Act, it used to be known as. They have to now magnify that down and zero it down, not just on our financial statements, but on our major programs. So they go in and identify which of the major programs, which in our case is our MTW program, and they identify that, and then they're required to test the compliance with the program requirements, and then whether we have internal controls over complying with the program. And in this circumstance, there was one finding where it has been an ongoing one that we've been addressing and slowly narrowing it down, and it revolves around the volume of the calculations of our eligibility. That is starting on page 97. And so if you go over to page 102, they discuss what the finding is, and they tell you what the sample size was out of our 12,000, almost 13,000 families. They found approximately 14 instances of noncompliance where we made a mathematical error, where we may not have gotten a form on time. Things that 40 was the sample size that they tested, but it was out of the population of our 13,000. Right. Exactly. And if you go over to page 103, they quantify that for you. So out of the 80, because there were 40 that they tested in the voucher program and 40 that they tested in public housing, that they had potentially question costs of about $32,000. So putting that in context with our $674 million. It's an error in any direction, in either direction. If you go over to page 106 is our corrective action plan. So we discuss with them the things that we increase training to staff. We institute a more thorough quality control testing where we go back and relook it and test it ourselves. We put in changes in procedure that will help us catch things that are untimely, et cetera.
This is definitely micromanagement, but is there cross checks? Like, that's how I would do it. I cross check myself against
each department and each function has something slightly different. A lot of them do have, it's more of a quality control, and I know, I think Michelle Hassan, Director Hassan, works probably with the bulk of it being the HCV program, and I know her staff has a process where it goes up the management level to be checked and signed off, and then, like I said, in hindsight, they also go back and do quality control where they'll pull some of these out, and depending if they find errors, that would be indicative that you need more training or retraining of staff.
Mm-hmm. Is this Section 8 or public housing or both?
This is both. So that essentially is the fiscal year ending 6/30 CAFR. If you had any other
is
questions.
Is page 104 the same or different?
104. So what 104 is page 102 is the fiscal year 16. And generally, if they audited in the prior year and had a finding, they're required to summarize what happened with that from fiscal 15 forward. So page 104 is actually the fiscal 15 finding, which is very much related to the same activity in the finding for 16. Like I said, it's an ongoing finding that we keep improving. Gotcha. And so in this case, you could see there were a lot more instances. So we're narrowing it down and kind of closing the gap on having these instances where we're either miscalculating or being untimely, et cetera.
And how many instances did we have in 2015?
Three, 40? It looks like we had about 10.
So we have more.
No, I believe there were actually less this year when I...
Okay.
Eight.
Okay.
Yeah.
Eight.
So eight in the current year, and there were about 10 in the prior year.
I thought you said.
We're whittling it away slowly but surely. My goal is next year to have no findings.
What?
That may never occur.
Yeah. Please don't say anything.
That's always got to have a goal.
It's a high standard.
But I would say, in terms of what Michelle's doing, is some of the interventions is to have people audit the files. In the past, when we were doing the Yardi conversion, staff was sort of derailed getting our business system and new system up and running. So we didn't have the same level of double checking, which goes on. So she's implemented some of that, which hopefully will have an improvement. But I would also say that the amount is, from our perspective, extraordinarily low.
Okay.
We Thank also you. Had one major misprogramming in the conversion to the new system that required her staff to go back and manually catch up with the recertification dates. So there was a timely.
And when we say it's better. Some of it is error not counting, for example, a medical deduction correctly, but the majority is actually the timing of the annual certifications and not doing them timely, so you get hit.
I have much respect for Director Hassan, so I know that she's got it.
So on note three, just one last question. Note three, the other restricted accounts, the police department has a restricted assets forfeiture account. What are we using those for?
He has, the Department of Justice kind of sets out the rules on what he's allowed to spend that on, and a lot of it is spent on officer training.
Training.
He can use it on other education programs or fitness and health.
Education programs, fitness, and health. That's good to know. Thank you. And the other question, since the authority has other miscellaneous restricted revenues, what are those?
I'm sorry, what page are you on?
Same note. Same note 3B. The authority has other miscellaneous restricted revenues in the amount of $17,000. There's just clarification questions for me. It's under D.
Yes, we have a couple of small accounts that one of them is Family and Community Partnerships, I believe, has about $14,000, which were funds, and I'll have to be honest, I'm not sure what their origin was, but they were given and restricted for the use of helping FSS participants receive training or buy tools or things that help them in the program.
Great. That's great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. And Chief, thank you. I love what you guys do. Chief. I love what you guys do.
I would say the asset forfeiture account, he used quite a bit of funds to do the toy drive.
Yeah, we've used a lot. The chief has taken advantage of the asset forfeiture funds over the years. They are drying up.
Okay.
And so we're trying to do an aggressive fundraising campaign through the Oakland Housing Authority Foundation.
Okay.
But those funds have really supported a whole lot of very important and otherwise activities we couldn't fund through our traditional programs, including the toy drive, some of Holiday Spender, and summer youth activities for our youth, among other things, and training for the officers.
Yes. Oh, that's it. Thank you.
So if there are no other questions?
Excellent presentation. Thank you so much.
So for this item, the board just has to accept it. So a motion to accept would be in order.
I will place that motion.
It's been motioned, accepted. We have to vote on it, right? Or
yep.
No? Okay, so all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Hearing none, it carries.
Thank you,
and Tracy, I just would like to say that this is an awesome accomplishment. I mean, I'm not kidding. I've seen a lot of financial reports. This is a very complicated business. This makes this business much easier to understand. And what I was really happy about today when I was reading through this thing is I became very clear on a whole lot of stuff I didn't understand. And that's what to me, that has just great, great value. And I've always felt that when you present financial information, it is always a story. It should come across like a story, and it should make sense and communicate something. And that's what you just did today. So I want to really thank you for that. I think it was terrific.
Excellent.
And so now we are... we are on to really good fun.
Yeah. Item G, the consent agenda. Now, I just want to point out the consent agenda. There's a lot of items on there because we had a lot to cover tonight. But I want to just remind everyone the consent agenda is considered our items we generally consider routine that don't require separate discussion. However, if a commissioner wants to have a discussion, you can always pull it. We're happy to pull and talk about any one of these. But in addition, you can also ask questions or clarifications and then take one action. And sometimes I think there's a reluctance. You don't want to really pull an item, you just want to ask a question. You can do that before we do the consent. If you want to pull it and hear more, we're happy to do that as well, but feel free to ask questions. I do want to also point out that there are a couple people in the audience here, and I want to recognize Don Stump, the executive director for Christian Church Homes, is here, and there's a project-based award for them, as well as Saha Sarah Abramowitz Hill, I think, is here. There you are, Sarah. Thank you. We also have Bradley Sia from Waste Management, whose contract is on consent as well. So just thank you for coming and sticking through our presentations. I appreciate it.
Would they like to speak?
No.
I do have a question, Chair.
Yeah.
And thank you for saying that, because I have a really simple question. I appreciate not having to pull the item. Mm-hmm. Just on the automobiles that we are purchasing, what are we going to do with the ones we're replacing?
The old ones have to be auctioned off. They go to an auction. It's a HUD requirement. Over the years, it's come up all the time. Can we sell them to staff? Have asked if they could buy them, and residents. It's not allowed. And we have to sell it at auction, and then the proceeds go back to the program.
Go back to program. Okay, thank you. That was my question. I appreciate that.
Cool. Okay, any more questions? If not, do we have a motion? Okay.
A motion. Second. Go ahead.
It has been moved by Marlene. Okay, and seconded by Barbara. Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously.
Thank you all. And I know you want to stick around for my comments. I'm just sure of it. But if you slip out, I won't take it personally.
Mostly I enjoyed your 106-page audit.
Welcome to my world.
Well, I also have to commend the brilliant strategy of placing this long list of consent items at the end of several hours of deep budget discussion.
It's the way we always do it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you all.
All right. So now we are, wow, look at that. That took up a whole page. Okay.
Now we're on to written communications.
Yes.
And we have three monthly reports. And, you know, one comment I did get from a commissioner, which is possible for the monthly reports when we have. H, you're right. I have no speaker cards. Anyone wishing to address the commission, we have no speaker cards, and they spoke during public comment. So now we're on G. The monthly reports of November, December, and January, I can get you the monthly reports every month, and then I'll still put them in the packet because the packet gets archived, and I like to have them archived by month. I did want to kind of walk through a couple comments on them because I think, you know, we've had some movement since we last met on these reports, and there's some things I'm kind of proud of and I think staff should be proud of. So I'm going to start with November and then a couple things from January. So I kind of skipped December to try and be brief. What I want to say is we had two residents who purchased homes through the home ownership program in November, and I just think that's wonderful. One bought a 4-bedroom single family home in East Oakland where they purchased a home for their existing housing choice voucher rental landlord. So they were living there under the program, and the landlord sold them the home.
Wow.
They had been there since 2009, and the landlord sold them the home at a price they could afford, which turned out to be $320,000, not the $600,000+ market price. And I think the world doesn't hear those stories enough about who we really are as a city and who we really are as a community, and that kind of commitment. I've heard this a couple of times in my career, and this was just something that really caught my eye in the report, and I wanted to just call it out because I think we don't say enough of those things. We had one previous homeowner, who sold their home for $405,000 and moved on from that home without any OHA assistance or subsidy, and they originally purchased the home in 2008 for $320,000. So they made about $885,000 in the interim in equity, which they then rolled into their new home, and they're completely off assistance. So I love those, and thanks to Lenita and her home ownership team over there for doing that. And the parent ambassadors for the month of November, three parent ambassadors resigned. We have two due to obtain full-time employment, and one to personal issues that didn't allow them to do it. I love the full-time employment, and I'm sorry about the part, but I wanted you to know we had three folks leave the program, and we'll be recruiting new ones, so you know. The Achievement Program, FEEP, which is being rebranded the Oakland Promise Plus, so it's going to dovetail into the city and OUSD's initiative, Oakland Promise, and we're going to be the plus, and the plus is we're going to case manage our families with children who are chronically absent, and like we're doing in the FEEP, but we're going to add in a network into all of the PLUS has to offer to make sure those children take advantage of everything from the scholarships at birth right through to their future presidency of the United States. And I'm not joking. I swear to God, the next president of this country, I'm sure a future president is growing up in one of my units. Every day I get up, and I believe that to my heart and soul. But I want to just highlight some of that. One achievement, the Achievement Project. One achievement, and I'm doing this for a reason. I'll tell you at the end. Achievement Project participant was referred to the PIC, the Private Industry Council for Employment Development Workshops and Assistance. One was referred to YMCA in East Oakland for Early Childhood Apprenticeship Program. One was referred to a Kerr Technology Center for some basic computer instruction so they could increase their computer skills. And the point is, we are linking the household to employment opportunities because that's what we identified as a need. And I think that's through an education program for the children. And I just really love the way that moved. I think that that's kind of the goal. When you're trying, saying, what role do we play in the education program as the home front, it's the whole family, and how can we help the whole family? And that's growing slowly but truly into something I think we can all really be proud of as a model. Also on October 29th, FCP hosted a construction careers information session at Lockwood Gardens for Cypress Mandela's pre-apprenticeship program. We want to get as many residents into that program as we can because we always want to shore up our apprenticeship program referrals that we do through our construction program. At the end of each monthly report, you'll see in green bolded where we are in terms of resident employment and Section 3 employment. I do that on purpose because I just want to call it out. So, and we do well. We're around 50% of our local hires all the time, and I think that's just terrific. A couple things from the January report. We had leased housing completed its purge of the 2011 wait list. There are currently 3,200 families left of the 10,000 from 2011 remaining on the wait list, and we'll continue to work through it and look at opening. We also opened the wait list for OPI for three-bedroom families for a few days in Deep East and East only. And this is getting toward the kind of policy strategy of having site-based wait lists and having wait lists open more frequently to put closer access to housing to families when they need it, rather than open a housing choice voucher wait list, which even ours is now 6 years old. No one's had an opportunity to get in the Section 8 program except the project-based awards we've made since 2011. As you know, I was somewhat critical of a neighboring jurisdiction that didn't open a wait list between 2000 and 2016 and chose to absorb. And I thought that was really detrimental to that jurisdiction. And what it turned us into is a portal in which they could get Section 8, move to Oakland for a year, and return back to their neighborhood. I thought that was not fulfilling the mission of the program for that agency, and I was not very supportive of it.
How many applied directly?
And what I want to bring up, how many applied? Mm-hmm. That's a good question. It's not in my mind, and I know what it is, but it's just not, it's not coming to my head. You know, I love to keep track of that stuff. I think it was about 10,000. What was it, Andres? We think it's going to end up being the two opening. Yeah, the two, three bedroom.
About
4,000 families. Some may be duplicate on both sides, so they're currently vetting through that to reduce it. We're not going to lotterize it, I don't believe. So we're going to try and get through the list because we think we have enough of the same families on both lists. So when we look at that, we'll keep them on both lists, whichever comes up first once we do it. I also, a couple other updates. The VASH, we have, you know, VASH has been a really challenging program, and that's the veterans program. We have 326 VASH vouchers. We currently have 300 leased, and that's an all-time program high for Michelle. We've had really trouble with getting referrals from the VA, and then when we got referrals, we had trouble finding units because the rental market had gotten so bad. We currently have 82 searching and 16 are in process. So that's all good news in terms of VASH. We're getting closer, and I'm really happy that we're getting closer because it's been a challenge. For portability, you know, I talked about the neighboring jurisdiction that didn't have a wait list open. There was one time in this agency's history where we had about 1,300 families ported to other jurisdictions. It's a huge amount of families that we're assisting in other jurisdictions, and those are families that are remaining kind of unassisted through our different programs, including project-based Section 8 and some of our local programs. And so we took an action to help deal with some of that through MTW authorities, but really the market kind of took care of it in large part because they started absorbing. We now have a total of 24 households ported from to other public housing authorities from this authority.
24.
And we're absorbing everybody who comes our way as well. I'm wrong. Total of 24 participants ported in this, and this is in January, so 24 came in. We have 14 unabsorbed from other jurisdictions. So we have 14 families that have actually living in, that are billing. So that's been a real bonus to the extent that it allows this agency to do more creative work with the resources that we have, and we're not paying people to live in neighboring jurisdictions and sometimes farther jurisdictions, and they've used their own resources in those communities. So what I wanted to talk to you about is how we're using that. So we've awarded a lot of project-based vouchers, including the ones tonight. We have a baseline number of how many households they're supposed to be serving in any in our traditional Section 8 program. And the baseline is 12,866 of our MTW vouchers. We have different pockets of specialized vouchers, but it's 12,866. Our actual units leased in January was 11,747, which is a lease-up rate that is, again, not good. We have our other local programs we've done. We have our other developed units that all count. But in terms of what's on the table, we have 1,119 households that could be served through the traditional program. So the actions we've taken to award almost 900 to existing families through the programs is going to really jump that gap. And when you add on the partnership with the county that we're developing for services-enriched housing and systems alignment, we're hoping to even fill it further. And then we have a few hundred out searching. We have 154 vouchers out searching right now, households. Between that, I really do hope we get back to 100 where we want to be, where we're trying to be, and where we can sustain that. But the longer-term plan is to try and lock down in a long-term contract as many units as we can. And I do that because I really believe that it's going to be very, very hard for any federal funding cuts to impact any currently housed families. And if they're going to cut the Section 8 program or even get rid of it at some point and change hopefully to something else if they do, but if they're going to take that action, I don't think they're going to take the action in a way that negatively impacts existing households. And I think having a long-term contract with for a project-based unit is really going to preserve the funding for that unit for at least the 15, if not the full 30 years. So it's a way of us, I think, getting through the next storm period with still being able to try and keep the service to our families' monthly assistance in place. I also want to note that we added 19 new landlords in January.
We did, but zero.
Yeah, January was 19 new. It may have been zero another month, but it was 19 new in January, and there is some indication that some of the rent sort of pressure is lessening a little bit. So that there are vacancies, and people are going to be able to have a little easier time. But, you know, we did also award a lot of units, and I think it'll make up a difference. I think the total of all of them is, if you project everyone, including the county, it's like 1,079 units that we want to try and get put online. For rent increases, we had 281 rent increase requests in January. So I'm using January as an example because it's the most recent reporting period. The average rate of rent increases approved was $502 a month. Think about the amount of rent that was. Now, a lot of times our Section 8 landlords don't come in for rent increases for several years because it's kind of hard to do. So they'll wait and wait, and then they come in. They can only come in once a year, but they sometimes wait 3-4 years, and these are probably the majority haven't been to us for a rent increase for quite a while. So it's a large rent increase, but that impacts the amount of housing assistance payment that we pay out. It's going to have, as they roll every year, and the number of families we can serve. Because remember, Section 8 is a balance between the number, the 12,000 plus, nearly 13,000, 12,866 families that are in the program, and also the money we receive from HUD. So you can either expend all the money or reach that limit of families is the way the rules work. Because we're MTW, we can actually exceed the 12,866. And, you know, for a lot of years up until sequestration, we were averaging 102% of that figure. So we stayed 2% above what was allowed lease up in addition to the other ways we're serving families. And we're able to do that because we have some pretty good solutions and do it economically compared to the neighborhood, because they calculate the fair market rents on the region. And so we do better in that, and we have lower rental markets than the region, so we actually have more money at the table and can serve more people. That is changing, is I guess my message with all this. And we're going to manage it a lot tighter. But I do want to try and get us this year, if we can, up to 100% and then fight the fight to keep every dollar that's serving families. In terms of special needs housing, We have, I'll cut all that and maybe go to our lease up, the next one. But I did want to mention, in terms of our special needs family, Alameda County has issued their RFP for services for the THP Plus program. We do have our language in their NOFA, and we've attended both of their bidders conferences, and we'll be presenting. They'll be awarding, the supervisors will be making the awards, we think, by June, which means we'll probably get requests and be back before you in September for those agencies that want to participate. One of the things that we're requiring is that we do 5 years of housing assistance, and the program at the county doesn't fund the 5 years, so the agencies will come to us. We're asking them to case manage and deal with a couple extra years, because I think it's a three-year program, and we'll continue the housing assistance. And the reason is we want to give a strong, I want a longer runway for those emancipated foster youth to get through their education program, to get through the first years of employment before they're sent off. It does not relate, this does not result in a Section 8 contract. It phases down the last 2 years, so it's a subsidy that will stagger down, and we're asking the nonprofits to continue to distribute the housing assistance during that period. The contracts will be with the service providers and not the county in this case, so the service providers will get the monthly assistance and they'll distribute it to the participants, landlord. Yeah. The other money that frees up that they get from the county can then be used in the way that it's really intended rather than just for housing. I also want to really congratulate Mark Schifferl and everybody in property management, because the public housing developments, the two big ones that we manage, Lockwood and Peralta, which are their own challenge, reached 98.15% occupancy, which is outstanding for public housing. It's about as high as you can get in public housing. But he's going to get it to 99. Is that what I heard, Mark? And that's all of the report. My notes on the report. We're here for any questions. And moving on, if there aren't any, I'll... Good.
It would be wonderful to submit that story about the landlord who sold the house to the Oakland Post or to someone that we could share that. Yeah. It would be really great. You were thinking the same thing?
Yeah. And we can't do it without the permission of everybody, so.
No, but it would be great if they would, if they're willing to disclose.
That is. Maybe
that's
we can.
That's some really good news.
Maybe Greer can look into that with Lenita and see if they're willing to participate or if they're too shy. I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's a wonderful story.
And after Measure A1, there seems to be a lot of movement in the county concerning finding some hard units, the conversation that we've had at this table for many, many years now. But the faith-based folks have really stepped up to the plate, and they're making themselves known that they have been attempting to help people who are unhoused in many different ways, like providing temporary shelter, providing permanent housing, and they are stepping into the conversation on how to respond to homelessness. And so under the Measure A1 matching funds, there might be some conversation on how to fund community houses that they may have or other types of transitional houses that they may have. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that that conversation kind of hits us in one way or the other and see if we can help somehow.
I will keep you up to date. I have a meeting scheduled with Linda Gardner to talk about the RFP and how they're issuing the bond money to see, make sure we can link to the greatest degree possible with their efforts and in the city of Oakland at least. And that's the monthly report. Any other? I'm going to bore you with other stuff. I know it's late, but we haven't met in a while. And I want, so the next one are written communications. I didn't go through the packet, and I'll spare you that. There are very few things, I think, because we had enough paper. So I don't know that I put much else in there. There were some letters and things that I think, I don't know, I don't see them in my packet, though, so I'm not sure if they're in it. But I won't walk through them. What I do want to do, though, is get to the comments, just the director's kind of comments and topics. And I'm going to read something, and it'll only, if you can bear with me, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was important, because I'm tired as you.
No, it's important.
So on Sunday, the White House released some idea of what their budget and goals were. And although this is only Monday, I wanted to give you my briefing, and I'm going to read you some stuff that I put together from today's correspondence, shall we say. So the what happens when they're doing a budget? The president announced his intent, which is really to because we need to spend more money on military. $54 billion on military. We need to cut other programs. It's not enough that 26 or so countries spend less than we do. So that's the agenda out there. The thing is, if you're going to do that, it leaves very few places to cut, because he's already said he won't touch certain entitlement programs. He wants to expand and find extra money for the military. So you're really talking about a few programs, of which we sit dead center in those. So the question becomes, how is he going to play that, and how will it play out on the Hill? The Hill will be reluctant, again, to cancel housing on existing families. Things that we hear, though, is that they could put a freeze, they could try and gradually do it, so there could be some mitigating factor on the Hill. The first step in developing a budget is the House Financial Services Committee does a thing they call views and estimates. Views and estimates have been released, which I want to read a couple things about what they're saying in it. And what views and estimates, it isn't the rules. It's like, these are what we think we need. This is kind of our policy of how we're going to go. This is how we want to build more weapons. We don't want to house more people. That's a view and estimate. So it's important how they're going to interpret it, and it makes a big difference. And so there's some quotes from that I think are worth calling out now, so we can kind of prepare ourselves for the next year and where we're going. The GAO office in 2012 wrote that there's 20 different federal government entities administering 160 program tax expenditures and other tools that support home ownership and rental housing, 160 programs. In particular, HUD received over $1.655 trillion in real dollars in appropriations over its 50 years of existence, and today spends $45 billion annually on at least 85 active programs. And this is a quote. Accordingly, the committee believes we must reform and innovate how we provide assistance for housing in the 21st century, and a higher purpose than simply perpetrating programs that ultimately warehouse and marginalize poor families and communities. The committee will investigate more efficient ways to deliver housing assistance within existing budget limitations, with the goals of helping people move from poverty to self-sufficiency, reforming HUD's mission and streamlining its complex bureaucratic web of programs, and developing meaningful innovations to assist communities and neighborhoods in spreading economic prosperity for all. Before I go on, they didn't say get rid of HUD. Quote, additionally, the committee believes we must evaluate public policies not by the good intentions of their proponents, but by the results they produce, and will work to develop more meaningful metrics for programmatic success based on how many people are graduated from federal assistance to economic self-sufficient lives. So that's their goal. It's a good goal. My challenge in our neighborhood is I don't understand how you can do that with the current income possibilities and wage limitations that we have here, combined with $2,100 on average for a two-bedroom apartment. I don't know how that works. And I just want to say I don't know how that works. It's going to be a challenge. It went on listing our two special programs, our two most important programs. I want to read what the committee said about that. Section 8 housing. The committee believes that the public is better served not by expanding Section 8, but by reforming the program to target need so that public housing authorities can serve more people within existing funding levels. The committee will continue to consider reforms to Section 8 and other assisted housing programs in order to identify and implement more efficient uses of taxpayer funds and to better help individuals achieve greater self-sufficiency. Public housing. Despite the investment of tens of billions of dollars in the development and maintenance of public housing units, the quality of such units continues to deteriorate. The committee recognizes that this trend is not sustainable and that new approaches to public housing are necessary, including the implementation of alternative means to finance affordable housing development. to make more capital available to maintain and rehabilitate public housing, the committee continues to support the concept of RAD. In the past, you know, the Democratic minority may actually pacify some of this, but what I wanted to say are the two things that I hear when I read this. And first, they're going to seriously discuss shallower subsidy for Section 8 and term limits in a way to serve more people with the same money or cut the cost in general. So I think we can the 30% income calculations, I think, are very much on the table. I think term limits for families who are able to work are very much on the table. And although that works in some neighborhoods, or some communities in this country, the idea of term limits for able-bodied households, because the rental market is very affordable, it doesn't work in some of the most impacted neighborhoods, including Oakland. But if you go to most of the larger metropolitan areas, particularly those by the coasts, it just doesn't work, which corresponds not coincidentally to states that are blue. So those are the politics around Section 8. Public housing is what it is. What they're telling you is they're still going to underfund it. If RAD works, that's great. We'll expand RAD, privatize it, and we'll be happy. We have very few public housing left. We have 1,600 and I think 8 units. I always get it wrong, Dominica, but I think 1,606 units. And out of that population of units, we have 3 large public housing family sites, which are just about 750 units. We have 383 senior sites, and then the rest have all been put into mixed finance redeveloped deals where they're sustained. So that it's not an impossible reach to do something about that. It's just, what do we do and when do we do it? Right now we support it through our MTW fungibility and the money we're receiving. But in the long term, we really do have to find a solution. I'm not sure what that's going to be, and we may have to wait 4 years till we reconsider that. So that's basically my report, and I don't want to end on a down note, but I wanted to kind of throw out where we were and what the real battle is. And I know some of you are going to go to NARO in March, and I just wanted you to hear what I see. I'll be going to CLOFA, by the way, the week prior, and I think 23rd and 24th, and your NARO is like the 26th, 27th, and 28th. So everyone's there at the same time talking housing. It's a good time for it because they're considering all this. It'll be interesting to listen as much as anything to what they're between the lines of what they're actually saying. So we hope to come back more informed and ready to face it. I don't think they're going to have much. We still, they have until, I think, it's April 27th to pass a continuing resolution or pass a new budget for the current fiscal year, which expires September 30th. I do not believe they're going to take that battle on. We may get a 2% cut, which would be fine. We can work with that in a continuing resolution. But I think that it's too late in the game, that the head of OMB has just been appointed, and I don't think they're going to get it done. I think they're going to focus on the 2018 fiscal year budget, and I think it could be the president's proposal and the House could be some serious cuts. So we'll prepare for that. We're currently doing our next year's budget. We're in the middle of the process. We're laying very flat. We have a couple new things we want to try that really are cost neutral in the bigger picture. But the reality is we're not going to be prepared. We can't look into the crystal ball at this point like I have in past years and said, I think we're going to have a 84% funding of this program or a 92% of this program and budget to where my best guess is. And as you know, our fiscal year starts July 1st. We won't know what the budget is from HUD until, should they make sure they don't go into sequestration again, but by September 30th. So you really have to guess and estimate where you think, what is the safe harbor for us? Where should we shoot in terms of developing the budget? This year we're laying flat. So we're doing what we're doing in this current year. We're rolling forward because, honestly, I haven't a clue and won't have a clue. So what will happen is once they pass the federal budget, if the cuts are significant, we are going to go back and redevelop a budget and come back to you with an amended budget as quickly as we can. Because the earlier we can do it in our first fiscal year means the less dramatic the cuts that we need to make. We have reserves that we're holding, and they're HUD-held reserves now, but there's enough funding to do what I call a soft landing, so we can really mitigate any impact on our existing families. But it will require changes to our internal funding of things like automobiles tonight. You know, it'll all be, all that stuff will be on the table first, and the directors all know that that's how we're kind of looking at it. That would depend. That could be forever. I mean, I really don't want it. I don't know. It's going to be a very challenging time to adapt. We are better positioned because of our economic activities that are in the blended component units than other agencies. And there's a reason we set it up that way. And this is the day we need to know why we set it up that way. It's to get us through these times. So, aside from that, a couple other notes. We have an HR director selection. They will be joining us in a couple weeks, so he'll be at the next meeting. Not here right now, but accepted the offer, and he's currently just a couple weeks' notice, and then he'll be on board more. So I'm happy about that. The other thing I just wanted to mention is we're looking at other... We've had challenges really recruiting staff based on some of our salary ranges, and that's due not primarily in terms of the cost of living. If people are thinking of making a job change, it's usually out of the area. So we're finding really hard time competing, and people want to work here, but we're competing. Some things that have helped is the alternate work schedule, the compressed work schedule, having every other Friday off. We were the only agency in this area that didn't. So that helps because it really does improve the quality of life for the employees, and they like that. But one of the things we're looking at is several salaries. We've been in discussions, and this goes back to when before Flo left with the chief, and that's continued with now Patricia helping out with the chief, to look at the police salaries because that's one of the hardest and selections we make, and we have vacancies that we're not able to fill. So we're really looking at their package. Some of this I do as an executive director. I authorize the ranges, but we think the package is going to involve things that change some of the way we hire our CalPERS, and it'll be something that we'll bring back before the board to try and find how we can be a little more competitive in hiring, you know, wonderful officers.
Do you have like bonuses to rent to come in? Because the rent is what's really bothersome. Right?
Partially. We do have several officers who live in OPE units at a reduced rent. That is done in a selective way, and certainly not everyone, we can't do it. The reason we actually do that, though, is not, it's a benefit to the officers who are doing it and participating. It's also a benefit to those neighborhoods. They take their vehicle home and park it in my parking lot because they can't take a unit home, but they sure can park one on my land in my parking lot. So that alone will make a huge difference. For example, 49th Avenue, where we've had issues in the past, we have someone there, and we try and scatter them. Officers, we're getting too clustered. I'm not sure how many we total have now. We always aimed for six, one in each of our geographic areas.
Okay.
So we're still working on that, but that's not really the barrier. I think it's the barrier is that the city of Oakland pays so much for their police officers, and we are so under the neighboring jurisdiction. So we need to do some equity adjustments. But there's some ways to do that based on their benefits rather than just their salary that are more cost benefit to us. And that's what we've been sorting through. And I think we have a pretty good proposal. We've been in discussions with the officers, so they're involved. And we expect to bring something forward probably in the next meeting. All right. And that's all my report. I want to thank you. I hope you all had a good break.
Can you talk about the STS notice, please?
The STS? I could. Do you really?
Yeah.
We did write a letter, and did you get all those letters? I think you did.
I think I got one of them.
So there's two letters, and I can walk through the here they all are. Thank you. So a couple things. If I walk through the written materials, one is to please pay attention to the Jobs Plus Family Community Partnerships upcoming events, because it's always a great resource. You can get an idea of all the stuff we're doing and referrals, because it's hard to find it in one place, and Lenita and her staff put this together, and I think it's terrific. We are called out in third grade Reading Success Matters, if you look at that. Then you have a lovely letter to our governor. I decided to include. I know you've all seen it. the main letter, the first letter you get on substantially the same with the MTW logo, which Greer did for us, by the way, when we were organizing all the MTW agencies. Thank you, Greer. It's still in heavy use. This is a letter just opining. What happened is they issued something in the Federal Register asking for, it's not the rulemaking process. They're asking for opinions. So they don't think it's subject to the ban that Trump put in, and they can keep asking about it. We have a lot at stake with substantially the same, and where this goes is I'll probably put it in a meeting that we have a smaller agenda between now and when they reach a conclusion. Right now, what you read was the joint letter, the steering committee of which we're on behalf of all the MTW agencies. That's the first letter, and it's, you know, well thought out and I think well organized. It's been vetted by us all and some of the best folks in the country. We also did, beyond that letter, we did our own letter, which did not make the packet. I put this in because we had it. We actually submitted it, I think, Friday after the packets went out. And so I'll try and include it next time. How you count how many families we serve under the program is important, because if they tie it to the wrong indicators and national funding levels of Section 8, they're going to require us to serve more people than we have money for. And we'll have no money for anything else. So there's a lot of variables in that formula that truly impact us, which is why we're opining ourselves beyond a lot of the agencies. And we feel fairly strong about our positions about if we're housing a person who's below 60% AMI unit in an affordable unit, whether they receive monthly assistance or not, isn't the statutory requirement. The requirement is that we serve them. And to me, that means we have some basis of ownership in either the land or the asset, the community, the limited partnership. I don't think you can argue around it. HUD is in our negotiations for the contract extension, we talked about this issue for 2.5 years. They don't move much. It's driven, not in small part, by Chicago, which is tremendously underutilized in terms of their money. They had masses of reserves that they built up. And it was caused by a couple different factors. When they entered the MTW program in 1998, they had received $1.5 billion from HUD for the plan for transformation.
Billion?
B as in billion. There's a documentary currently on PBS about this, by the way. And if you want to know more about it, I'm happy to pontificate, because I've been around it all. And the problem, as you know, is I go on into too much detail. But in this case, they got that money. And at the time, they had 24,000 public housing units, of which 17,000 were occupied. So they entered the MTW program getting subsidy for 24,000 families, the money, but they were only serving 17,000. So HUD said, all you have to serve is 17,000, even though they were getting funding for 24,000. And that has gone on now. Since they entered the program, which is 1999, is when the contract was signed. That's the problem. The other problem is, even in the plan for transformation and the many plans that they have subsequently submitted for approval to HUD, they have been very successful at tearing down developments and not very successful at building back units. And I could quote one past executive director who I knew, not one in the Bay Area, who I knew quite well, and laughed and said, we're going to do a plan. They're going to love our plan, but they're not going to, it's just a plan. So they've done a series of those. So that community alone is causing a great deal of grief and damage to us all, because what they're doing is trying to regulate toward that. And we will all sort of, and that's been true really since the beginning of the extension negotiations. There was a moment, I've mentioned this, where we were all asked to fly in to meet with the Chicago residents. And I did, and the organizers. I wasn't going to go, and I actually got a call from the assistant secretary saying, we're not going to do this unless you get on a plane and come out and meet with them. They were so nervous about how people, some of the other steering committee members, would react or engage and discuss. But it turned out to be really a positive day. I personally enjoyed it a lot. And I love talking to the resident leaders from the home. I love getting Nancy Couch from National Housing, whatever. And I had a really good day, and they weren't wrong. And I think that was the thing that everyone had to hear, and I think HUD did get that message across. My issue is it's a local issue. It's not a national issue, and that there are the solutions that they want have nothing to do with me. They have to do with that agency, and they have perfect ability to do those solutions. So that's, I don't want to take, it's nine, it's late, but I'm happy to talk about this at another meeting and other times. It's an important issue for us. What? I don't know the name of it.
70 acres.
Yeah, which is Cabrini Green, 74 acres. Is Cabrini, yeah, 70? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, which was full of buildings that were 16 stories tall with 16 units on each floor. Yeah, and they're still working on it, by the way. It's not over. That story is not at all over.
Is the HUD plan for 100 more MTWs based over several years?
We are graced by having one of the select, and I would say the one, two former participants and or current participants that were selected nationally to participate on an advisory board to help make those decisions, and I wasn't able to call in, and you went there, and I didn't watch it very closely after the first one.
We had a close phone call, but this is pre-new administration.
Yeah.
And I haven't heard anything. We kind of sat down and started moving towards making recommendations to the administration, but truly, it's been really silent, which was my next question. Has lines of communication opened with our new Mr. Carlson, Dr. Carlson?
He's not sworn in yet. He's supposed to be sworn in later this week, but that was as of this morning.
Okay.
And once he is sworn in, I think it's going to take a while to get his feet wet. And I do think there should the expansion that we saw is I think that there's room to expand it further. But you got to remember one of the dangers of MTW is it's a block grant program. It's easier to cut a block grant than to cut a family.
I think it's in jeopardy.
Yeah, and that's, well, you know, the current administration is going to love MTW.
Okay.
But they're going to cut the funding over time should it go larger. So I don't know where that work's going to go in terms of the 100, but they've got it in appropriations from last year of what they need to do. What I have heard in general from the Hill is that there is MTW fatigue. Meaning, we're all sick of talking about it. We've talked about it now for 2 years while we were banging on doors to get our extension. We don't really want to talk about it anymore. And in appropriations, when we got the language, which included the inspection, but the expansion and a couple of other requests around MTW, the main one for us is to preserve our existing contracts for the next 10 years. And generally, they're like, we gave you what you want, now go away. So that's when I say fatigue, they're not really interested in blocking out time to talk to us anymore. And that may continue. And the one thing I'll tell you is that they have a lot of agenda items in this administration. MTW or even HUD may not be the top of that list.
No.
Money will be, though, and that could translate to cuts with us. I don't know that they'll get many program changes going on in the first couple years. The other thing to remember is HOTMA, which was the Act, Housing Change Act. What was it called?
Through Modernization Act,
passed in September unanimously in both houses and was signed by the president. So there's some concurrence that we should move some things forward and not necessarily horrible opposition to anything regarding that, because it was unanimous and it is possible, I think, to still have progress in our housing programs. And I think that's going to come from the Hill, not from the White House. And in the past, I think it was more driven by the administration than the Hill. And just finishing what we have summer youth employment, our report we got from the city. Just to note, the March 27th regular meeting occurs on Cesar Chavez Day, so it will be canceled. We will have the meeting on April 3rd, and that's when the plan and the two changes to the ACOP and AMIA plan will return, and on the back are any travel that you might want to be interested in this year that's approved as of December's meeting. That concludes my report.
Excellent. I believe we had no committee meetings over the last month. But we haven't had any to report on. So next time we will. Okay, so do we have any announcements by commissioners?
I have one, sir. I'd like to dedicate this meeting to one of our RAB members who we lost. I believe it was maybe several months now. Her name is Olivia Williams. And we just kind of wanted to maybe have a moment of silence just to remember her.
Olivia Williams,
the resident advisory board member that we lost recently. Just a short moment of silence in her memory, please. Thank you.
Okay.
I have one quick announcement, maybe a happy place. We did an RFP for the supportive services model of for $15 million, and we were lucky recipients. So we're going to have one building in Oakland is going to have supportive services. That means we can hire a 40-hour wellness nurse on an affordable housing property. There's one building in San Francisco and one in Southern California. So out of 796 applicants, we have three in the Bay Area, and we're just overjoyed that this.
When you say we, who are you talking about?
Well, for me, okay. I'm talking about Beacon Communities.
There you go.
But I flagship all affordable housing because
excellent.
This was a big deal. So if this supportive services model goes through, I feel like the glass is a little half empty with our new administration. But if this goes through, it's going to show, and we're going to get more money
yes.
to have supportive services and housing. So that's a big darn deal. So.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Most excellent. Okay, then I guess if no more comments, we need a motion to adjourn.
I will make that motion, Chair.
And so it is. Have a happy month.
Thank you all.